in which I don't believe anything, including my own ideas. Right? Maybe you get that place sometimes, you know? Yes. It's like all of a sudden, like all the ideas, it just seem like they're just ideas. And who gives a fuck anyway, right? And there's a kind of depression that comes with it, right? And there's this kind of huge, bleak desolation. Right? It's like we look around and the world just seems meaningless and frustrating and contradictory. I see Ted's nodding. So you guys know about this place, right? And thank you so much. Okay. And I want to bring it up because it's really, because we all know about this, and in fact, in our culture, a lot of people live in this place permanently. Right? Deconstructionists, for example, or a lot of businessmen that I know, they just sort of, if you try to engage them in any sort of philosophy, they'll pull this. You know, they'll say, well, ideas don't matter. Human beings are too small to have ideas that have any relevance to reality anyway. And the only reason you're having these thoughts is because you want to feel good about life and you haven't got the guts to accept the fact that life is really meaningless. You guys familiar with this sort of position? We meet it all the time. Now, so I'm in it today. And I usually don't go here, right? So it's really interesting to be here and to really be able to now feel from the inside what this position is like. And this is something I commend to all of you, right? It's like you can never understand a position unless you can feel its truth from the inside. This is true of any philosophy that you study. If you can't figure out why the person who wrote it felt it was true and believe it with them, you haven't understood it. After you understand it, you can criticize it. You better understand it first, right? So I've finally gotten myself into this mindset where everything is meaningless. And it's fascinating because, for one thing, I find that it is impossible to articulate this mood as a position. So all my life, people have been coming at me with this mood, and I keep asking, what's your position? If you say things are absurd, why are they absurd? What's your interpretation of reality in terms of which things don't make sense? And then they can never answer me. And now I understand why. Because to say that the world is absurd is a performative contradiction. Do you guys know what a performative contradiction is? It's something where you're saying something, and the very fact that you're saying shows that it's false. Like if I were to say, I am not yelling, that would be a performative contradiction, right? So to say ideas are meaningless is a performative contradiction. You can't do it, because to say it is already to imply a massive complex of philosophical assumptions that's unifying your experience. So you can say it's meaningless, which is actually a very complex, highly rational judgment that we're placing on things, and it's really hard to get there. And if you want to claim things are absurd, you have to work really hard at it, and you have to ignore the obvious ways in which things are totally meaningful. You see what I'm getting at? Right? And so these people who tell you everything is meaningless, they can't make that a position. Because if they really try to defend it, the minute they try to defend it, they've lost their ground. So it's an attitude. It's an attitude which refuses the seduction of ideas. You hear what I'm saying? Right? And so we all have in us this capacity, out of disappointment or bitterness or whatever other motive we have, to just simply decline the invitation of ideas and not to live in a world, or to pretend not to live in a world that's defined by them. You follow what I'm saying? Right. Now, in fact, what we observe is that people who reject the allure of ideas are entirely possessed by unconscious ideation. Right? So my friends who say this, if I try to press them, they'll start talking to me about, you know, everything is probability, and so there's a million probabilities, and nothing means anything because everything's equally probable. Shit like that, right? None of which makes any sense. When you actually look into it, it's absurd. So anyway, I noticed that people who adopt this attitude allow themselves to be unconsciously possessed by ordinary common ideas, which they claim are so obvious they don't really involve thought, whereas any dispassionate inspection reveals them to be thoughts and nothing else. Right? We can't live without thoughts. The structure of our universe is a thought structure. Without concepts, our experience cannot be ordered into the experience of a world. And yet, we can have this attitude of saying all ideas are bullshit. This is fascinating. I couldn't go on today without sharing that with you. Right? I'm going to be presenting these ideas as if I believe them, and I usually believe them. But this week, I'm not sure I believe them. Right? And this seems to me to be a very, very important thing. Not only is it important in general, but I think that all the teaching I'm doing these days is an attempt to formulate a rationally comprehensible understanding of the integral era of human consciousness into which we are entering. I think everything is changing at a really, really deep level. And I'm trying to think through the changes. Right? I'm trying to expand mentality sufficiently so it can be transparent to myth and magic. And that's what I'm working on. But what happens is that as we move from the mental into the integral, we hit a shock. And this shock is a terrifying freedom. An utterly terrifying freedom. Right, so we go back to the mental era. We go back to Aristotle, for example. Right? And he believed in a rational universe. So he believed that the categories of the ideas, the structures of reality, are there for humans. And humans are there for them. And so it's all one system, right? And so the logic that humans use, in fact, for Aristotle, the logic that the Greeks use was the logic of the whole universe. And it was all very nice and tight, right? So you looked at it, at the universe, it was a sphere, you know, this big sphere around the sun, and we're inside it, and everything makes sense, nice and coherent, right? And now that sphere is shattered, right? So at the Renaissance, the sphere shattered. We'll talk about this more later. And then we ended up in this big universe of an empty cube, this huge, empty Newtonian cube universe, and that's now shattered. Right? And so we arrive at a situation in terms of human self-definition. We arrive at a situation in which we start to recognize that all of our ideas carry the mark of the arbitrary. That every body of ideas that we generate is in some significant way a human artifact that shapes our experience of the universe into a human world, but there are infinite number of ways in which that can be done. Right? So the way that we happen to draw the boundaries of what's objective and what's subjective are purely culturally and historically defined. There are other cultures and other mutations of consciousness in which reality is experienced in very different ways. And so we start to realize that the way we construe reality is a choice. Now, like in the modern world, we have a tendency to imagine that that the physical world that's been disclosed by physics is the real world, with a capital R. And we assume that these laws of physics that we in our glory have discovered are eternal laws that have applied to everything that's ever happened since the Big Bang, and that ultimately those laws determine everything, including human consciousness. Now we see that's not the case. Right? Those are just a set of laws that describe certain parts of our experience, and we can define our reality in totally new ways. And there's this terrifying freedom. There is nothing objective that we can rest into so it will give us back a definition of ourselves. Because objectivity is a construct in which we participate. And so the way in which we render the world objective is an intersubjective process. And so there's this huge freedom. Like, now what? Now what is reality? If all of our definitions of objectivity are constructs,
would somehow relate us to some unknowable reality of which we're a part, right?
What's real? And we don't know, right? And so we hit this shock at the beginning of the integral. And this shock has a shadow. And the shadow of the shock is despair. We start to realize all this freedom, and suddenly we have no sense of ground to rest on. We don't know who and what we are. We don't know how to define the world. And there's a temptation, certainly in me, to just want to give up. Fuck, it's too complicated. Right? I just want to retreat. It's all these ideas don't mean anything, right? So I get in that mood. Follow me? Right? So this is why I brought this up, because I feel it's actually important. The experience I'm having, we've all had it probably at some point or other. We're all going to go through it. And it's interesting to know this experience as a mark of the transition to the integral. But on the other hand, I don't want to depart here without giving the despair its due. Right? And so I tried something similar to what I'm doing today in my class in Sophia yesterday. And it didn't work because they couldn't rest into the despair. They simply couldn't do it. Like, the minute they got what I was saying, they had to immediately make it into something good. Right? Oh, this despair is a transition to something. Or, you know, like, something like that, right? They had to bring it back into the positive story. Immediately. They couldn't just sit in the despair. And I want to invite you to spend a minute just sitting in the despair. Like, oh, fuck. We don't know what's going on here. Right? Our civilization's lost its way. We're philosophically and psychologically and spiritually lost. Right? And we have these ideas that we throw out to try to cast a net to sort of screen out the abyss with some signal of coherence. Right? And yet there's some way in which it never really succeeds. Right? There's always some way in which you really don't know. Right? Unless there's some enlightenment experience, right? But short of that, it's kind of this darkness, right? This abyss. And our whole civilization is standing on the edge of the abyss of meaninglessness. So, anybody want to say anything? Yeah.
I think what's ironic about the situation is that this attempt to order chaos,
yeah,
is at the heart of the creative process, and that's why we have this difficulty of, all right, I know that I need to be creative, I know that I need to express some idea or expand mentality in a way that's going to be at least temporarily satisfying to me. But at the same time, there is that realization that you also need to just sit in it in order to actually understand that creativity that's necessary.
Beautiful. Beautifully said.
And the shock also is, I think, mentality is trying to do two different things. It's trying to expand, as you said, but it's also trying to recognize its collapse in order to expand.
Yeah.
So
beautifully said. Beautifully said. Very nice. And so it's a great honor to me to be able to share this moment with you. You know, it's like, just to know that lurking in the background is this abyss. And our words are spanning the abyss. Maybe. So, thank you for going here with me.
I think for me it also kind of highlights how our attempt to make meaning, particularly a positive meaning story, you know, can be used as a kind of defense mechanism.
It is a defense mechanism, that's right. And to the extent it's a defense mechanism, it inhibits clear thought. Because if we are unable to sit in the despair, at least for a while, our thinking is completely distorted because we're compulsively giving positive spins to everything. Right? And then, you know, like, I mean, ultimately things probably are positive because it's impossible to rationally formulate the negative alternative. This is weird. And yet we can all feel it. And it's there and it's important. So, yeah.
It seems like we have to become more proficient at, would it be the the mythical ability to hold the polarities.
Yes.
So that we can have that, and it's okay.
That's beautiful. Nicely said.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right. So it does require that in some way this meaninglessness is a kind of cramp of the mental consciousness. Because in the mythic world that we're going to discuss in a few minutes, there's no such thing as meaninglessness. It can't even be conceptualized. Right? So we get into this mental cramp in which everything seems meaningless. And yet it's an important place because it's so culturally important to us. Right? And because we have to be able to look at it and feel it if we're going to liberate our own thinking from emotional compulsion. You know, I've been reading Kassir. And this idea of anthropology, you know, like, what is humankind? What does it mean to be human? And a lot of times, in the various schools that have tried to answer this question, there's a sense of a human obligation, that somehow humanity is defined by an obligation, which in many schools is an ethical imperative. Right? Human beings are seen as fundamentally ethical beings by many religious philosophies, right? And so the whole, all of life is a drama. Basically, for the Middle Ages, the entire planet was a stage setting in which the moral drama of heaven and hell was played out, right, by individual human beings. That's an anthropology, moral anthropology. Right? There are also cognitive anthropologies. All the ancient world, right, talk about the need, the obligation of reason. That human beings are the beings with the obligation to think things through. That's what makes us human, right, is that we engage in dialectic and that we think things through. This is the whole, all ancient world is based on this particular anthropology. And I feel it. I think it still motivates a lot of us that there's some feeling that we have a rational, that we have a moral obligation to rationally think things through, that somehow our humanness and our rationality are very closely tied to each other in some important way.
To Caleb?
Back to what you were talking about earlier, people refusing to engage in the rational dialogue. I think we have an intuition that knows things, and that's distinct from our a mind that understands things. And sometimes we know things, but we can't articulate them in the proper language, or
that's
we don't understand the language that it's being told to us. So when we hear something, we're like, nope, that's not true, because I know this is true, and something's not
accurate.
Right. So I think different personalities of people lend towards more intuitive knowing versus logical understanding. And they feel threatened by the imposition of a logical argument that they don't have the skills to work with.
That's correct.
It's going to come to a conclusion that's going to like counterdict their intuitive knowing. And so when we work in the mental realm with ideas, we always need to understand that they have a context of intuition, rationality, practical application, and then finally an emotional, which I think is meaning, is an emotional connection to the conclusions that we come up with.
Yeah, I just, the only thing of what you're saying, it's basically I agree with it, but I would urge a lot of caution in your use of the word intuition. Because there's rational knowing and then there's other kinds of knowing. And those other kinds of knowing are legion. So for example, a lot of what passes for intuition is simply lazy repetition of thoughts that have been received. It's not intuition at all.
Yeah,
And so we have to be clear about what exactly we mean by intuition. And we need an epistemology which clarifies precisely what are the transmental forms of knowing and how do they relate to the mental.
Well, that's good. I think that's a really interesting question. Trans-physical and then the transmental knowings or transmental understanding. That's really opened up some thoughts here.
Yeah. So hopefully we'll have a chance.
You said transmental, right?
Did I say that?
No.
I said transmental. Transmental. Yeah. And what are the forms of knowing that we have that are beyond the mental? Some of them we have infrarational ways of knowing, and we have suprarational ways of knowing. What we need is a typology of the means of knowledge, and the relationship between them. Sri Aurobindo has a very interesting way he does this, but we can talk about that some other time. All right. Any more questions on this little introductory remark or anything else you want to say about philosophy we talked about last time? And if not, we'll go into the material for today. deep breath. So last week we talked about the transphysical worlds, and I got a sense that nobody who's taken this class has any huge difficulty defining what the transphysical worlds mean. And I think our discussion last time was adequate to at least establish that we all have some idea what we're talking about. You okay with that? Everybody has some sort of general idea of what we mean by transphysical world and so forth. Okay. So what I want to talk about today is how the transphysical worlds can be experienced in everyday waking life. But in order to do that, I want to talk a little bit about, a lot actually, about the structure of human experience. The structure of human experience. Now, this is not something that we ordinarily think about, because generally speaking, in our education and in our everyday life, we don't look at our experience, but rather we look through our experience at objects. You know what I'm talking about? Right? So at this moment, as I speak, I'm looking through my visual experiences at you so I can communicate with you, right? And so I'm not noticing my own experience. I'm noticing the objects that my experience gives me access to. You with me on that? Right? So I'm looking through my experience out into what I imagine to be a world out there. You all feel that, looking through experience? Okay, now what happens if you stop looking through experience and instead start looking at experience? Right, so here we are. What is our experience? What is my experience right now? And as I say this, I want you to think about your own experience. Right? So I notice that right now, my experience is much dominated by my visual field. I'm very aware of what I'm seeing. But then I also have my tactile feelings coming in and the various emotions in my body that are sort of sending up their messages, right? And then I can, and all these different senses coming in, and I also have these moods and intuitions and apprehensions. This is all my very complex field of experience that's going on at this moment. You all with me on that? Now we can look, for example, at the visual field, and we can start exploring the structure of the visual field. Some of you have heard this before, right? But it's really interesting to notice that if you fix your eyes somewhere and begin studying your visual field, you might do this, right? You notice that if you look straight ahead, you can't exactly make out what's going on the sides. And that somewhere along the way, your hands will fade out. Try that. But you can't see the edge, right? But somehow your hands will fade out. But you can't see the edge, right? And so you've got this interesting structure, this kind of field of vision. And then within it, you've got these regions of color. And what's interesting about the visual field is that generally the patches don't overlap. They're sort of, the visual field is kind of tessellated with patches of color, covered with patches of color. And then we have an auditory field and so forth. So we have all these experiences, this whole very complex experience. And then we have this whole way in which all of these different experiences are assembled into a picture of me in the world. Right? Sort of interpreted into a picture. And so now we're looking at experience. This is human experience. And we begin to realize, as we look at human experience, what's revealed to us increasingly is the constructed nature of experience. Right? So for example, we know that color perception does not depend primarily on the frequency of the light reaching the eye. It depends rather on the relationship between the color in one part of the field and the colors that are around it. And so the exact same frequency of light will look like a different color depending on what colors are surrounding it. Right? And so in some way, even our experience of color involves comparison and construction and interpretation. Right? So even looking around the room and seeing that Teresa's name is Teresa, and her shirt's green, right? So noticing her green shirt is an interpretation. Right? It involves activity on my part. It turns out, as we look into it more deeply, if you study the Kantian tradition and so forth, you begin to realize that even space and time are constructs. We construct a certain spatio-temporal model, and then we let those perceptions that we can place in the model count as objective. And the ones that don't fit in the model, we call subjective.
Just to speak to that, there's forms of meditation, which is just basically, there's lots of ways of being conscious of your own experience. The forms of meditation that they've studied under electrodes, and seen that the prefrontal cortex actually increases with this sort of reflective consciousness of just watching your own experience. So the actual physical brain is changing, which...
What's the importance of that?
The importance is just that it's a physical example.
And why is that important?
It's important because...
Are you assuming that the physical is what's really real? Are you assuming that mind consciousness is a function of the brain?
Yes.
Yeah. See, I think that's an assumption I would like you to really question. That's one of the fundamental questions of modernity, and it limits our understanding.
Right.
And it's a common assumption, right? Because we're drilled into it. But that's the primary assumption I want to destroy in this class,
right,
is the idea that there's some objective physical world out there, and it defines us. Rather, I want to reveal the physical world to you as an interpretive construct within the domain of experience. Not as something real and ultimate out beyond us, but as simply an interpretive structure that we use to organize certain parts of our experience.
Thank you. I've been tormented by that.
All right.
That's why I wanted to bring it up.
Okay.
I've been using that model and not knowing exactly why.
Right.
It was so important to me.
Excellent. Beautiful.
Thank you, Scott.
All right, so the point I want to make overall here.
I have a quick question about that.
Please.
Is it possible that the assumption has also gotten in the way of us actually taking that idea seriously, and that's why we've been looking at the brain as opposed to all of the matter as not containing consciousness but playing a part in the conscious process?
Absolutely. It's an assumption that's getting our way hugely.
Yeah. And
it's
even in physical science.
Even in physical science, it's wrong, right? And that's what Whitehead's all about, is showing us how we can get scientific results without having to make these silly assumptions about the nature of physical matter and why it's ultimately the real thing, which it isn't, right? The whole point is we need a way to understand why science works without making silly Newtonian assumptions about reality. That's our task. That's our moral obligation here, right? If we're going to move ahead into the integral, if we're going to construct a civilization which values life everywhere, which experiences the preciousness of life and experiences the unity of the cosmos in some meaningful way, then we have to disabuse ourselves of silly Newtonian notions, right? Which are silly once they're examined, but aren't silly if we take them for granted, because then they just seem like the way things really are. So we are capable of making assumptions about reality and of living as if those assumptions are true, even if those assumptions will not withstand rational criticism. Right? It has been known since Newton that the Newtonian view of the world had to be wrong. Blake said, "Save us from Newton's one-eyed sleep." Right, because you recognize that Newton's perspective was too narrow. One eye, right? It's a vision without perspective. It's a flat land. That was known by Blake. The entire Romantic movement, most of Western philosophy from the time of Newton, has been a big protest against the utter incoherence of Newton's ideas. And yet, we still act as if we live in a Newtonian universe. This is really interesting. Right, so philosophy is not just about ideas. Right? Philosophy is about the organizing ideas that live in language and live in culture and impose interpretations of experience on us, which we then hold on to for all kinds of psychological and spiritual reasons, which have nothing to do with their rational coherence. This is a very interesting human situation. Right? Philosophy is really important because we need to know what the ideas are that are organizing our experience. Now, anything else? Okay, good. Yeah.
I
I guess where I'm getting a little confused is that, so we, even if we know that what you're saying is true, there's a way of acting that makes us in tune with that. And I feel like that's where the major disconnect seems to be, is that we act one way, but we think we believe something else.
That's correct.
And so
Well said.
I think that's where I'm getting so confused, is that I know what you're saying. I agree with you, and I understand that, but I'm still living in this reality.
That's right.
And that's where my disconnect happens every day, all the time.
That's what we're all living through. Right. I mean, that's it. Like, that's what it means to be living at the very beginning of the integral era. Right? It means that we now are able to apprehend the new forms of knowledge. We're beginning to sense them. We're beginning to be able to articulate them. But we haven't learned to live them. And living them is a collective effort. Right? It's like, in order to make these ideas effective as a world that we're living in, we have to speak the language together. Right? Because it is through language that we make the world objective to us. It's through language that the world, the human world, emerges out of the overwhelming richness of natural experience. Right? Because the human world is an abstract world. Space, time, cause, right? You know, like that, right? Abstract. What's the question you just asked me?
I guess I'm hoping
that... Oh, yeah. So we have to live this together, right? And so my whole objective in teaching is to try to find people who will speak the language with me so we can begin to create this new reality. I feel like I've sort of gone as far as I can without collaborating. So it's not keep teaching, right? It's like, right? I need people to collaborate with in bringing this new world into being. I've got some language for it, but that's not hardly... That's just a little... One requirement. There's a lot of other requirements to make it into a world. Okay, so... So coming back to Gebser, the point I want to get from Gebser, and the reason I had you read it, is because Gebser, one of the most amazing revelations of Gebser is his understanding of the extreme plasticity of human experience. That human experience has the capacity to be reorganized in ways that we have hardly begun to imagine. And the reason for this, the way we can get a feeling for the plasticity of human experience is in two ways. It's first of all in looking at the organization of the senses. Organization of the senses. And secondarily at the unifying ideas. Through which the chaos of experience is reduced to the unity of a coherent moment of experience, right? So every moment, and I'm claiming this now, but I'm going to say a lot more about it later, but every moment is a process of interpretation. In every moment, the world flows into us, right? Through our senses, but also, as we'll see, directly, not through our senses. The world's flooding in on us. And in every moment, we have to selectively pay attention so that we can draw out a meaningful world. Like, I pay attention to the right angles there so I can draw out the whiteboard. I pay attention to those right angles so I can draw out the light. See what I'm saying? Right? And so at every moment we pay attention to certain details and we allow those details to be organized into a play of objects among which we live. Now, interpretation is involved. In every moment, in order to see the world as a unity, I have to subject it to the discipline of certain ideas. For example, time and space, right? The set of ideas that I use to organize reality into a coherent picture, and so forth. By and large, during waking life, our attention is dominated by the data coming in through our sensory channels. Basically, at this moment, all of you are pretty much entranced by your visual and your auditory channels. Right? You're involved in looking at me and listening to me and having a reaction to that. But at other times, different senses are predominant. So for example, when you're having sex, it might be much more tactile. And at certain points in having sex, you might close your eyes and the visual becomes irrelevant. It's all tactile and auditory, let's say, right? So we can see that in different experiences, we organize our senses in different ways. Also, it's become really clear that in the historical unfolding of humanity, the way in which we organize our sensory experience is variable. So, for example, in the earlier phases of human consciousness, the auditory channel was the most important. It was all about hearing. Then we got to the mental mutation, all of a sudden all the senses got reorganized and vision came out on top. And so vision became the most predominant sense. Schlein talks about that in the book, The Goddess and the Alphabet. Right? There's a definite shift in the organization of the senses between pre-mental times and mental times. Right? Now, so we can see that we can rearrange the priority of our senses. But it turns out that we also have a much larger number of senses than we ordinarily give ourselves credit for. I just got this book in the mail which claims to identify 17 different senses. I haven't read the book yet. But just thinking about it, I recognize a whole sense I never thought of before, which is balance. Balance is a sense organ, right? So there we go. And a sense organ. There are probably lots of other ones. I'll read this book and find out what they are. You get the idea, right? So not only are there more than five sense organs in the waking world, but also we have a lot of other sense channels that are not operative in the waking world. So for example, I fall asleep and I have a dream. And in the dream, I'm seeing things. So that's my transphysical vision. It's another sense. And then in dreams, it's as if I hear things. It's not the same as in waking life. It's different, right? But there's a kind of transphysical audition. And there are certainly transphysical proprioceptions and feelings, right? And so we have a whole other set of senses, which are non-physical senses, that belong to our transphysical bodies, but are available to us, right? Like we can just close our eyes and see pictures, right? That's our transphysical senses. So what's happened is that during the last few thousand years, we have obsessively paid attention to the five physical senses and tried to build up our whole picture of reality on the data from the five physical senses. And not only that, we haven't just taken the data from the five physical senses, we've taken a rigid subset of that data, which is exactly those perceptual experiences that are relevant to operations of measurement. And we've claimed that those are the only experiences we have that put us in contact with the real world. Do you see any problem with this, right? This picture? Right? It's like, hey, this is real. Right? What about that? What about the reality of this? Right? So the point I want to make is that we have way more senses than we usually use, and that the way in which we organize those perceptions in our experience is very highly variable. And so I am convinced, for reasons that I hope will become clear, that as we move into the integral mutation, we're going to be experiencing a radical reorganization of the configuration of our senses. And we're going to begin to pay much more attention to the data coming from our transphysical senses. And we see indications of that. We see people on TV channeling dead people. That's a good sign that these things are beginning to awaken, right? They're beginning to come back and fight. I mean, these transphysical senses that we have were actually driven deep into the unconscious by the witch trials at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, right? Where anybody who had access to the transphysical senses was burned at the stake. That's pretty traumatic. And our civilization is still suffering from that trauma. We're still afraid to talk about these things, right? It's still a trauma of the Inquisition moving through our body, moving through our memories. But it's breaking down. It's been a couple hundred years. These things are coming back and moving into the integral mutation. And so we're going to start seeing more and more breakthroughs of these transphysical senses. So that's one of the ways in which our experience is very variable. And the other way it's variable is in terms of the ideas that we use to organize our experience. And it turns out those are also radically variable. So Gebser, building on this notion of the variability of human experience, gives us a theory of the different mutations through which consciousness has gone. And I hope you all did the reading on that, so you have some idea what I'm talking about. How many of you did the reading? Not bad. Good. Okay. So let's talk about some of these mutations. Gebser mentions five of them. The archaic, the magical, the mythical, and the mental. The archaic mutation is very difficult to talk about. I don't really know what it means exactly, but the system seems logically to assume that all these mutations arise out of some unity, some condition of unity in which the human experience and the cosmic experience are not differentiated from each other, in which there is no sense of individuality. Whether this is a previous golden age or whether it's some animal condition, I don't know. I don't really get the archaic exactly well. Gebser tells us two things about it. He says, in the archaic age, how does he put it? The men of old slept dreamlessly. Something about not dreaming in the archaic era, before dreaming, some way. And also they say that in the archaic period, we couldn't differentiate between green and blue. It was odd, right? A certain color blindness. It would be totally crazy if it weren't for the fact that infants also, when they're born, have this blue-green color blindness, which suggests there's something interesting about it. So here's my riff on that. You're walking in the woods, and you look up at the trees. They're beautiful. They're green. And then behind them is the blue sky. Right? So there's this big contrast between the trees and the sky in color. And the contrast in color pushes the sky back and creates a sense of distance between the sky and the trees. Now imagine you're walking in the woods and you can't discriminate blue and green. And so the trees are green and the sky is green. And so there's no distance. And so there's no sense of spatial expansion. It's just all here. Right? Do you see how different that would be? So this is some way of trying to get a glimpse of the archaic. But then we come to the magical. And the magical mutation is the way our hunting and gathering ancestors lived. Now, first of all, our hunting and gathering ancestors did not make the distinction that we make between the physical senses and the transphysical senses. The clear distinction between the physical senses and the transphysical senses is a modern invention. It's 300 or 400 years old. That's it. Previous to that, people just saw things. And some of the things were gods and goddesses and demons and angels, and some of them were physical things, and they were just things people saw. And there was no attempt to sort of create this big differentiation where a lot of things fit into the physical box and everything else is imaginary. Instead, it was all just what we see. Right? And so our magical ancestors lived in a much vaster world than we do. Right? They weren't confined to the physical world. They hadn't even discovered the physical world. They were in this world that was a world full of dream dimensions, right? And just angels and demons and UFOs and aliens, all this stuff is just common to them every day. They're living in a much more complicated world, right? So their senses are organized in a vastly different way. And the way they organize experience is fundamentally different. So out of the magical mutation, the organization of consciousness is point-like, which means that in general, people are kind of asleep. Really, by our standards, it's kind of an automatic. But then something will wake them up. And what wakes them up into a moment of consciousness is a synchronicity. Suddenly, something significant seems to be happening. And there's this moment of consciousness that happens, this moment of self-consciousness. And this moment of self-consciousness is a complete mandala. It's a mandala, right? It's a complete coherent picture of the world. And it's not just a spatial picture of the current moment. It's a completely different form of space-time construction, so that in a magical moment, events from what we would call different parts of time are all part of the current moment, simultaneously existing. Right. So the big example I've used before is Gebser's example of pygmies who wake up at 4 in the morning to go hunting. And so they go down to the water, to the riverbank, 3 or 4 of these guys. No words are spoken. They just wake up, they go to the riverbank, they draw an antelope in the sand, and then they step back with their bow and arrow.
And then at the precise instant the sun crests the horizon, they shoot an arrow into the neck of the sand antelope on this bank there, right? And then they go wandering off in the woods, and they come back 5 hours later with an antelope shot through the neck at exactly the place they had shot this antelope on the sand, right? Now, for them, this is no accident. For them, this is all one incident. Right? The whole incident already happened at the moment they shot the arrow. The one moment that they experienced covers large, disparate areas of what we would call time. And it's a completely different organization of experience in which there are these episodic experiences of complexes of events stretched across time and space and all unified into a single present. And then it's gone. That's magical consciousness. Right? It's not sustained. There's no sense of sustained personal identity. And Gebser suggests that magical peoples are quite telepathic. So they're actually seeing the world through each other's eyes. And so there's no way they could possibly construct something like perspective of space. They have no conception of space. There's just happenings of a kind that we can hardly imagine. Now, if per impossibile we were to go back there and test their DNA, it would be just like ours. These were human beings, just like we are, right? They came out of wombs, just like we did, right? They threw balls and ate food, just like we did. But they lived in a different universe. And they had a technology based on their own experience, right? So that when they shot the arrow into the neck of the sand antelope, they knew they were going to get fed. That's technology, synchronistic technology, right? Different universe. And yeah, Linda.
I don't know if this is going to be coherent, but how does that fit in with Whitehead and with drops of experience and with things happening in succession? So when one occasion happens, it has all the past occasions flowing into it. But here it seems like they're kind of happening at different times, but all at the same time for their experience.
Yeah,
so.
That's a wonderful question. And I will say, I have two answers, two partial answers. One of them is that one of the reasons I love Whitehead is that he really is transparent to the magical and the mythical. It's an important way. So Whitehead's notion of an actual occasion is a synchronicity. An actual occasion is the meaningful coincidence of the entirety of the past and the present. It's a profound synchronicity. Right? So Whitehead points out that the fundamental building blocks of human experience are synchronicities. Moment to moment, our existence is a synchronicity. Moment to moment, you will never find your experienced world to be incoherent. It just doesn't happen. Right? At every moment, everything lined up into some sort of world picture. It's amazing, right? And if it weren't for the fact that every moment is already intrinsically coherent, and if that coherence weren't somehow given to us by some factor which transcends the finite, if it weren't for that situation, no human knowledge would be possible whatsoever, right? Because mythical knowledge and mental knowledge can be shown to be abstractions from this magical knowledge which underlies everything. If it weren't for the fact that moment to moment, pre-scientifically, precognitively in some sense, our experience is always coherent. If that weren't true, we couldn't have anything. We couldn't have science, we couldn't have culture, we couldn't have a world, right? So this is the magical level that Whitehead makes transparent to us. On the other hand, Whitehead doesn't do that well with the mythic. It has to be worked hard. You can get there. But Whitehead is very wedded to a linear sense of time. And I think that has to be questioned for a lot of reasons. Partly because the experimental evidence for precognition is becoming overwhelming. And so we have to rethink some of that linearity of time in Whitehead.
Are we saying the physical world is linear and the transphysical worlds don't have to be linear?
No, not saying that at all. I'm saying in a Whitehead's philosophy, things are accounted for in a linear way. The linearity of time is important for Whitehead's philosophy, and yet our understanding of the magical consciousness, our understanding of the reality of precognition, are showing us that Whitehead's understanding of time has to be too narrow.
Well, can you measure time if it's not linear?
No, but of course, measuring time is pretty irrelevant.
So I'm saying in the physical world, it would seem that that time has to be linear, whereas in the transphysical world, it's not a requirement.
No, because even in the physical world, I'm not sure the linearity of time is as significant as we think it is. Because look at synchronicities. You know, if they could shoot an arrow into a sand antelope, and that's causally implicated in their getting one out in the woods, there's something going on there that can't be accounted for by physics. They're actually causally efficacious patterns that are not, cannot be captured by physics. In other words,
well, there may be the transphysical causations that can't be captured by the physical world.
No, I don't want to go there. I don't want to do that because after all, we have non-local interactions even in the physical world. We have various kinds of precognition relevant to the physical world. We have quantum theory in which retroactive causation is a valid category. I'm just not willing to concede that linearity is a property of the physical world as an objective something. It is certainly a property of all models of physics, right? But it's not necessarily a property of anything beyond the models of physics.
It seems that linearity of time is what measurement is the space where the ruler...
That's right. You can't have any measurement without the linearity of time. Okay. And so physics depends on the linearity of time. But whether the linearity of time is ultimate in any sense, or whether it's simply a convenient abstraction for use in dealing with certain characteristics of low-grade occasions, that's what I'm not prepared to say. Yeah?
Well, this seems to relate to what you were coming up with earlier about how I'm really sleep deprived today, so I'm not being very coherent, but you were talking about how we basically construct our reality or we interpret reality, and so we've had a very successful run with interpreting reality in a mental way,
yep.
Which includes time as clock time, linear, but that is successful only in certain contexts, probably because it's only true in certain contexts, yeah. If that makes sense.
Yeah, that sounds fine.
I just keep thinking of Flatland where the sphere comes through and it's just out of nowhere, this nothing starts becoming a circle and then it disappears, like a sphere through a plane.
Right. Yeah.
And that seems to me like the trans-physical world intersecting the physical world, so even though in the physical world, there's linearity. The causations are occurring from another world as it intersects the physical one.
You
know, I don't know if that's...
It's a reasonable hypothesis, and it's one way of trying to express what I'm trying to express. I'm going to try to suggest some other language I think is a little more elegant and helpful, but the idea is basically the same. Okay?
I think the linearity of the language is what might be the biggest problem here. Like, if you were able to tell that story to us instantly, as opposed to in chapters, then
right.
It wouldn't be so hard to fathom. They actually experience it that way.
That's right. I read the other day, Paul's not here today. Paul was telling me that Suzanne Langer points out that that discursiveness, that language is discursive. What that means is that you can only say one word at a time. And that imposes all kinds of problems. All right, so now we talked about the magical somewhat, right? And the main point, I really commend to you, try to imagine what it would be like to be naked in the woods without any education of any of the kind that we've had, right? But just right there, you know? And how you would think, what life would be like, right? You begin to get a sense of the magical world. The idea is to imagine your way into a pre-mental world, and it's fascinating. The exercise is amazing, and it breaks open a lot of assumptions that we ordinarily make about reality. Like, we assume, 90% of the time, I even assume this 60% of the time, that really our hunting-gathering ancestors live in the same world that we do, and the same laws of physics applied back then. But I'm not sure that's true, actually. I'm not sure that's true. So anyway, so we have this magical world, and what I'm trying to say is that magical connections, synchronistic interconnections, are causally efficacious. They really make things happen. So at Lourdes, the story is, people go into the healing chamber, underground, water, great mother, a lot of archetypal symbolism, and so Gebser claims they regress to a magical state in which everything is one. Now in that state, somebody might go in with a withered arm, And then all the arms in the room become one arm. And the arm heals itself. And they'll come out with a whole arm. This is the kind of thing that happens at Lourdes. Now, there's no physics explanation for that. You can't do it in terms of physics. And yet, something has trumped the laws of physics. Magical interconnectivity and magical intentionality and magical unity have overridden the laws of physics, which are thereby shown not to be the default condition, right? It means that there are powers that are stronger than physical causation. And as we delve deeper into our own experience, we can access the parts of ourselves which can dictate configurations of events irrespective of physics. See what I'm getting at here? Right? Like when those pygmies shot the arrow into the sand antelope, they were already killing the flesh and blood antelope. That was not random or coincidental. That was an actual causal effect. And we see it happening around us in extraordinary moments. Right? Moments of magical causality. Right? They happen to us. Right? So then, okay, what I'm saying is that that's still real. Okay, now we move to the mythical. Now, in the magical, going back for one second, the primary, there are obviously there's no philosophy, but looking back, we could say that the category that organizes their thinking is mana. Right? Mana is just this pre-personal force, pre-personal glamour, pre-personal impressiveness that can be indifferently belong to people or objects, and it's not personal and so forth. Right? They have this whole philosophy, sort of philosophy, based on this understanding of mana, the impersonal power that gives synchronicity and that makes things emerge into importance and experience. Now, when we get to the mythical understanding, instead of thinking about everything in terms of mana, we get the gods and the goddesses. Right? So what happens is mana gets broken up into the gods and the goddesses, who are sort of a rainbow display of mana. But the whole category of person enters into human experience. Before that, nobody thought about themselves as persons. The category person did not exist in thought until the mythic era, the mythic mutation of consciousness, which now brings in persons, right? And so now we begin to imagine the whole universe is behind the universe or above the universe is this whole world of families of gods and goddesses who somehow impose their will and create coherence and justice in the human cosmos, right? So, and in the mythic consciousness, everything is dominated by cycles, right? So the planetary cycles, right? The sun cycle, the moon cycle, especially the moon cycle, right, begin to become extremely important. And these cycles, so instead of just having these moments of vivid synchronicity, we now start noticing that the synchronicities recur. Right? So there's a big synchronicity that happens when the first blades of grass come out in spring, and lo and behold, that same synchronicity happens the next year. We begin to notice it's the same synchronicity again. So we get this sense of return, right? And this sense of process, of cyclical process. And also in the mythic understanding, everything is symbolic, so the connections among things are much more symbolic than they are literal. Like you discover a healing plant because it looks like it'll do the healing, right? Because there's an actual visual resonance there. And so you begin to look at everything in the universe, the form of everything is expressing symbolic meaning. And so the symbolic interconnections way overwhelm causal connections in consciousness. We're still thinking causally when it comes to like hitching the horse to the plow. That's pretty causal, right? But when we're thinking about how reality works, we're thinking in terms of gods and goddesses. We're thinking in terms of symbolic resonance. We're thinking in terms of the magical efficacy of ritual ceremony, right, in which we symbolically organize things. And so we create a symbolic ceremony which is designed to influence the outcome of events. Now, if you read Kassirer, for example, almost any modern person, they'll tell you how that was an illusion that people had to grow out of. And Kassirer and I are saying, no, that's not an illusion. That's a deeper perception of reality. Because we all know that ritual means a lot. Right? That we do rituals and they change reality. In fact, again, I will claim that ritual efficacy or the efficacy of like sympathetic magic, like wearing amulets and wearing certain colors to bring about certain effects and so forth, that that's all real, that it's true, and that it actually trumps physical causes, that it's more determinative of the flow of events than physical causes are. The only place you can find physical causes operating really clearly is in an experimental situation. And an experimental situation is set up precisely to exclude magical and mythical efficacy. Right? Now, everywhere in real life, we see magical and mythical efficacy dominating our existence. It doesn't happen in scientific experiments because it's excluded from scientific experiments. Right? So, I'm going to say one more thing, right? That in the mythical world, whereas in the magical world, there's a sense of unity. Everything just is in this perfect synchronistic moment. In the mythical world, there begins to be a sense of the flow of time. And the flow of time is defined by polarities. Right? So you now start to get polarities like light and dark, day and night, pleasure and pain, good and evil, birth and death, decay and growth. All of these different polarities. Right? And the universe seems to be a field of polarities, and there's a movement that goes from one extreme to the other, right? It goes from winter to summer and back to winter, around and around. It goes from life to death, back and forth. It goes from physical to transphysical, back and forth, right? And so just as life and death becomes complements, the transphysical worlds and the physical world become complements. We cycle through them. In death, we go into the transphysical worlds. In life, we come back here. And so the transphysical worlds are totally part of everyday experience, but they're held to be in a sort of polarity contrast with waking life. Okay, now, notice that in this world, in this mythic world, there's no such thing as geometry. And there is no conception of distance, of measurable distance. Mythical peoples don't know anything about measurable distances, hardly all, right? I mean, yeah, it takes an hour to walk to their neighbor's house, right? But when you think in any kind of scientific sense, there's no idea. Rather, people experience the world as if it's a dream. In mythic consciousness, people experience the world as if it's a dream, right? So we look at dreams and we interpret them. Why do we interpret them? Because everything is symbolically resonant in the dream field. But everything is symbolically resonant in the day world, too. It's just that we ignore the symbolic resonances in favor of our highly narrow and abstract scientific considerations. Right? So I'm saying that in the mythical world, which only ended 2,500 years ago, it's very recent, in the mythical world, when people looked around the world, they didn't see this extended mathematical space. They were just living a dream in which things are symbolically interconnected, and the symbolic interconnections were the really important ones, and the rest of them are pretty trivial. You see that? Okay, yeah.
Well, I see that, but I mean, I'm thinking a lot about the Egyptians,
mm-hmm. right?
But they did have a use of some kinds of measurement, like for fields and flooding and stuff like that. But I guess maybe that was the sort of the incipient mental.
Absolutely.
But so okay, so yeah.
Yeah, right. I think whenever you see that kind of measurement, you're seeing incipient inceptions of the mental.
Yeah.
And I think whenever there's a city state, you start to see inceptions of the mental.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was thinking from the magical or mythic perspective, a mental experiment seems like. Just like shooting the antelope in the sand, it's the same type of magic that's taking place, setting up this experiment
yeah.
to get this result. And of course you're going to get some results because that's that's the cool. premise that you're going into it with and creating this magic
that's right.
potion. And
actually, in fact, I would go further. I would say that, you know, Gebser says magic is doing without knowing. Right? Technology is deficient magic. And in fact, if you go into a factory, what you're seeing is an extraordinarily elaborate black magic ceremony being conducted. Factories are black magic ceremonials. Right? In which people
say it's black because it's ignorant.
Yeah, because it's manipulative. In other words, white magic works with the subject, subject to subject. Black magic works with the other as an object and forces, whereas white magic invites black magic forces. Right, so here we have a bunch of people in this incredibly rigid ceremonial structure. I mean, they show up precisely at the same hour every day. They go to the same place. They do the same actions every single day. Right, they wear special ceremonial clothes. Right, they create a special pure atmosphere for the ceremony. Right,
it sucks their souls dry.
And then they use this whole ceremony to destroy matter and to manipulate it according to black magic intentions that are purely selfish. Right, so. These important stuff. I'm not joking about
this. And is that like, in, for you, how do you hold that? Is that an objective factor that you...
What does that mean?
I mean, like, that sounds like a very subjective interpretation. It's compelling.
Yeah, well, all interpretations are subjective to some extent. That's the whole question, is what do we mean by objective? That's
absolutely
the question.
But right? It sounds to me like you're putting it out there as sort of a third-person fact.
Yes, well, I am... Because every fact, there is no fact without theory. Period.
Absolutely.
Everybody agree with that? No theory, no fact, right? And so my theory about my new metaphysical theory discloses new facts. Right? So I would claim, if you buy my metaphysical theory, then it's a fact that factors are black magic. If you don't buy it, it's not a fact.
Okay, yeah, that's good context to understand what you're saying.
Thank you, I really appreciate that, because you will find that I often speak authoritatively like that. Mm-hmm. But I expect you to disagree with me if you don't like it. You're adults, right? I'm not going to stand there every minute and qualify what I'm saying. I'm going to assume that you guys are smart enough to say, that's bullshit, I don't like that. And you can fight me if you don't like it. I'm just going to say it. It's a lure for feeling. To you, right? I'm going to say it because it's more powerful that way. If you believe me, I'll be really happy. And if you don't, that'll be really interesting to me also. Right?
I was taught not to say I think in my papers, just to say it, because obviously I think it, otherwise I wouldn't be writing it. But that was my generation, and it seems like a younger generation was taught to be more careful with what they say and not be so opinionated and be open to possibilities. And but
that's right.
I feel a generational gap.
There may be a bit of a generational gap, and I want you all to know that I'm learning a lot from you in terms of your extreme sensitivity to these issues. Because without your input, I can become a little bit of a male chauvinist pig. and so I am becoming more sensitive to these things, and I don't mind being reminded. But my normal way of speaking tends to be fairly authoritative, and I just want you all to know that I love being questioned. And you'll find out that's true. You won't find me being defensive if you question my ideas.
Well, I don't think we should talk about pigs that way. But... I don't mean. Well, I'm a vegan at all.
Last question. I didn't want to finish this up before the break. Yeah.
So, just quickly on one hand, so Aboriginal culture would be mythic with dream time?
No, Aboriginal would be magical.
Magical. Okay.
Mythic is village agriculture.
Right. And then I have a question about. So it's a little ambiguous when you talk about physics as to whether you many times mean Newtonian, mistaken common sense of physics, whereas you use a lot, Whitehead uses a lot of quantum mechanics to get the choice, the possibilities.
Yep. But you see, Whitehead doesn't actually use quantum mechanics. Whitehead was inspired by quantum mechanics.
I thought he did. There's well, some books he wrote on.
No. But
He wrote on relativity.
Yeah. And he was unquestionably inspired by quantum mechanics. But what's interesting, if you look at Whitehead, is that he began to develop the quantum mechanical notions purely abstractly, out of an examination of experience. Right? And so Whitehead is generating an interpretation of experience, which was inspired by quantum mechanics and is therefore coherent with quantum mechanics. But he doesn't rely on quantum mechanical results.
Right. And his inspiration is a different source that he's getting.
Yeah, in fact, I'm pretty clear. Well, you guys talk about this after class, but I'm pretty clear that Whitehead's understanding requires a reformulation of the equations of quantum mechanics, which were built on a conceptually incoherent foundation.
I know they get all the right results. I'm not saying that should be questioned. I know how accurate the quantum mechanical formalisms are. But I know, for example, that Bohm reformulated them completely
right. In
order to make a deterministic interpretation of quantum theory.
See, I disagree with that. And here's sort of the heart of my question. So if quantum mechanics is consistent, when it comes to causality, the famous modern thing about quantum mechanics, of course, is quantum locality.
Yeah. You know, I want to hold this question. I don't want to get to the quantum theory.
Okay, good.
I'd love to talk to you about it, but I've got some stuff I really want to cover.
Yeah. Okay,
so I want to go through finish this before the break. So we go from the mythical. I talked about the mythical and how in the mythical world, the transphysical worlds are a polarity with the waking world. Okay? Now we get to the mental world, which comes in, as far as we're concerned, with the Greeks and the Athenian miracle. That's when it really sort of gets established in Western culture. And what we see in the mental mutation is that the gods and the goddesses are stuffed, killed, stuffed, and turned into effigies. Right? So before the modern era, you ask, what is justice? And someone says, it's a goddess. What does that mean? Well, justice as a goddess has moods and complex personal reactions and changes from mind and is, you know, like that, right? But then along comes Socrates and he says, no, I don't mean that. I mean, what's the definition of justice? What's the definition of goodness? Now, what does that mean, definition, right? Well, I don't exactly know. But the point is, a definition is not a goddess or a god. It's dead. The object of a definition is an idea. Right? So an idea is an abstraction from a god or a goddess. It's a dead god or a dead goddess, right? Instead of having a living principle of justice in the world, we now have a dead idea of justice presiding over the world. And so what you get in the mental mutation for the first time, ideas are recognized as such. Right? Ideas are pulled out of the flow of experience and named and looked at for the first time in the mental mutation. And so, and also what happens in the mental mutation is that time is experienced as linear for the first time. And so for the very first time, instead of being this endless cycle where the future is the direction from which the past is returning, now we have linear time, where we're moving from the past into the future. It's the time of purpose, the time of human purpose. Holding a purpose across time makes time linear, right? And then we begin to divide time up. So time becomes divided by the meal times. Those are the primordial differentiations of time, right? Breakfast, lunch, and dinner, right? They're all divisions of time. And once you start thinking about time as having divisions that way, then you can think, how far can I walk between breakfast and lunch? That becomes measurable distance. It's the very first idea of measurable distance, is when you start to linearize time, you begin to get some idea of distance as something that can be covered in a given period of fixed time. So now the third dimensional world opens up, geometry opens up. And so we now have a completely new universe that comes in at the time of the Greeks. It's a geometrical universe. There was no geometry before it comes to the mental mutation. All of a sudden, we step back, we start looking at time, and time and space, and analyzing in terms of points and lines and logical relations. This is brand new in human experience. The world, the physical world, emerges into human consciousness for the very first time with the Greeks. So at this point, now, where does the transphysical worlds go? Well, to begin with, the Greeks, when they start to think about space, aren't thinking about cubes. They're thinking about spheres. Right? So for the Greeks, space is naturally and always spherical. And the solar system is a sphere, and we're at the center of the sphere, and at the outer edge of the sphere is this black glass sort of globe, and then God's out there on the other side of the globe, and the stars are little holes in the globe where God's light shines through. You can see that if you lie down at night, look up at the sky, it's beautiful. You can feel it, right? There you are in the medieval world. It looks just like that, right? Now, in that circular world, space was anisomorphic. Right? Modern space is isomorphic. It has the same form, isomorphic, everywhere. Everywhere you go in space, it's got the same cubical form in the modern world. Right? And all points in space are equal, completely equal. They're just designations of abstract positions. But if you go back to Aristotle's world, space has qualities. Right? So as you go up above the surface of the Earth, you're moving into transphysical worlds. Because between the Earth and the outer sphere of the solar system are these worlds where these gods and goddesses live in orders of increasing harmony and glory as they approach God. And then if you go down under the Earth, you get all the Earth spirits and all the cathartic spirits and all the evil spirits. So that according to Dante's cosmology, the center of the Earth is Satan's anus. And it's core, that's what he said, right? Core of evil, right there, right? So what you have is a psychologically, what we would call a psychologically meaningful space. And space is reflective of humans. Each human is a microcosm of space, of the whole solar system, and the solar system includes all the forces of good and evil and all the forces that motivate human beings. All the transphysical worlds are contained in the solar system. Right? And so we have now a notion of space, but the notion of space reaches out to encompass the transphysical. You see what I'm saying? Okay, now we get to the Renaissance. And we have a shift from what Gebser calls the mental mutation to the deficient mental mutation. There's a collapse in the mental mutation, which happens in the Renaissance. And the mark of the collapse is the discovery of perspective. So for 2,500 years, starting with the Greeks, according to Gebser, human species have been struggling to master space. What's space about? And at the Renaissance, this effort culminates. And space is finally understood in terms of perspective. Right? So now, the sphere that surrounded the solar system is completely shattered. And what replaces it is an endless, infinite array of cubes. Now, when you're doing a perspectival painting, you've got to think in terms of cubes. Right? You take a cube of space and you transform it into a square of picture. Right? So there's this great plate from the Renaissance, shows this artist painting a woman. And the woman is gorgeous and voluptuous, just breathtaking. And she's right there naked on the table in front of the artist, right? And in between the artist and this gorgeous naked woman is a grid, like a window, like sort of a window of like, you know, cross-hatching, right? So he's looking at her through a grid so he can transfer her square by square onto paper. What a way to relate to a woman. Right? Put up a screen. That's how we then relate to nature. We put up a square screen between us and nature. And the sensual involvement is lost, right, behind this three-dimensional grid structure. Right? So the spherical space is shattered, and now we have an infinite array of cubes that goes on forever with chunks of rock and thermonuclear explosions in it. That's it. Right? Now, where did the angels go? Where did the demons go? Right? Where did the transphysical worlds go? They're gone. After the Renaissance, we come up with a cosmology in which there are no transphysical worlds. In fact, there's no subjective experience in this new world that we create, right? And so the very idea of transphysical worlds begins to become an object of mockery. At best, it's a fantasy. At best, it's some kind of relief from the harsh realities of the actual world. Anybody who believes in the transphysical world becomes soft-minded, childish, and are subject to infantile wish fulfillments and don't really damn thing, right? That's where the transphysical world's going in the modern era for the last 300 years. So it's only since the Renaissance, and really only since the 1700s, since the witch trials, right, that we have banished the transphysical worlds from reality. What happens is that about 100 years after they're banished, they reappear in culture, and they come back in the form of the unconscious. Right, so all those parts of reality that were banished from physical space show up 100 years later in psychological space, in the unconscious, in the collective unconscious, right? And in this space of the collective unconscious, they're completely mythical. Again, it's all symbolic interconnections. Jung talks about the collective unconscious as images. Right? But this word images disguises so many meanings. Right? Because the images are the images of transphysical beings who are talking to us. And the images are the archetypal images which are operative on all the different worlds and so forth, right? So we end up with this very confusing situation. The modern world, the transphysical worlds, when they're acknowledged at all, are acknowledged in a completely mythic way as the unconscious. But we have lost any sense of the transphysical world as objective realms of being. That's where we stand right now. Yeah.
I'm not sure how to say this. That wasn't done consciously, but if I'm thinking from the standpoint of consciousness evolving, is this just a phase for us to experience things in this sort of objective way, which isn't really objective, in order to then understand the next level?
Well, to begin with, this is not necessarily an evolution that we're talking about. In fact, I would suggest that the movement through the mutations is even more a devolution than it is an involution. Because if we adopt a anthropology, if we adopt a theory of humanity in which spirituality is central and in which intimacy with nature is central to what it means to be human, then all the stages from the archaic down to the current efficient mental have been a descent. We've gotten further and further away from God and further away from nature, and retreated more and more into increasingly artificial ecosystems as this has gone on. Now, in some sense, it's been progress. It's been progress in that we have learned to think in a much more general way. And we've learned to universalize our ideas, to create this sense of this vast space of possibility that's a universe. They didn't have that in the old days, right? We also have discovered individuality in a new way, for better or for worse. So a lot's been going on in these mutations, not all of which is bad. But in general, it's been a descent. So I never want to say it's a stage, you know. I want to be a little more balanced about that. You know, it's miserable. But on the other hand, it does seem to be part of a cycle. And the people who studied this cycle over the ages, who know a lot more than I do, they suggest that we're at the lowest part of the cycle, and we're getting ready to go back to the shoot up to the beginning of the cycle again. That the integral age will be a new golden age. A new divine dispensation. And so a lot of people in this department will argue that our alienation in the current world was somehow necessary. And they'll give you this birth metaphor. And they'll want to say the current modern world is like the third perinatal matrix. Now, in my personal opinion, that metaphor is being way overused. But it's okay. Yeah?
Is devolution in this idea similar to involution? And could you see these stages in the development of a child, for example, in the culture? As he comes to progressively...
Yes, people do recapitulate these stages. And the first part you said was...
Well, that's partly involution, right?
That's a very complicated... But I do think that there is an involutionary movement involved in the cycle. That in some way... The movement is an involutionary movement, and that it we get closer and closer to the physical world through this movement. It's an evolutionary movement.
Yeah. Meditation.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
It's a quick question, and I think it'll come up again later. But I'm a little bit confused about the difference between the archaic and the integral consciousness.
Yeah. Good question. Excellent question. I'm confused about it too, but here's something that Gebser says. He says that the integral is a new octave of the archaic. So we're returning to the archaic, somehow transformed by this involutionary journey that we've been through. And that I agree with everybody else. I just don't like the birth metaphor so much. It's an aesthetic thing, yeah.
Is it like a spiral so that the mutations are circular but you're arriving?
Yes. Exactly.
What's the end of this?
Well, it depends. You know? I mean, that's a great question. In fact, answering that question is critical in the formation of an anthropology. Where does the cycle go? Does it have an ultimate culmination? Right. So, and the answer we give to that question has a lot to do with how we understand our project as humans. So Teilhard de Chardin, for example, has this idea that the next stage in evolution on the spiral would be for us to give up our individualities and all merge into this noosphere, this collective human consciousness, and that collective human consciousness would leave the earth behind as a burnt cinder and go off to participate in some higher consummation somewhere else. That's Teilhard de Chardin's vision. Schiaparelli's vision is that evolution will work until it produces a fully incarnated divinity, so that the God who created the entire evolutionary process will walk on two legs on this planet. That's Schiaparelli's vision of where we're going. I don't know which one's right, but I think, you know, that asking the question you did is huge, because our sense of our destiny depends on how we answer that question. Now, we have a Star Trek vision. Star Trek vision says we produce greater and greater gadgetry until we can fly around the universe in mobile office buildings like great transnational bureaucrats, and ultimately by doing that we'll achieve galactic federation and transcend the physical world. That's the Star Trek version of the human of anthropology.
Blow up more shit with ever larger weapons.
That's the big part of it. Yeah. But so the point is, what I'm saying to you is we need an anthropology. Right? We need an understanding of what humanity is. And I'm claiming that in most cases, our anthropology and our cosmology are totally tied up together. And that if we work out a multi-world cosmology in which the transphysical worlds are part of the actual world, it leads to a completely different understanding of what it means to be a human being.
If you go to our anthropology department, it seems they've suffered from the mental mutation to the point where they don't even ask those questions anymore.
It's very sad.
Postmodern deconstruction and...
Yeah, it's sad. Okay, let's take a break. Let's come back at 1:30. During the break, we can take a moment of mourning for our colleagues. By the way, I'm in the process of getting posted on YouTube a series of 5 lectures that I did on the transphysical worlds a couple of years ago. I did it for the Esalen people. And so if you go to YouTube and search for me, you'll find 5 lectures on these materials which may be helpful to you supplementing what we're doing here. So the waking world. Now, we always talk about the physical world. And then we have this weird idea that when we wake up in the morning and open our eyes, we're in the physical world. But that's actually not true. Right? Because, in fact, the physical world consists of low-grade occasions of inorganic things, like atoms and molecules, right? That's the physical world. The physical world is a world of very low-grade intelligences operating under the dominance of habit and law in a very rigid way. It's the world studied by physicists, right? We don't wake up into the world studied by physicists. We wake up into a world that has things like trees and houses and people and meanings and love and all kinds of things in it that physicists don't know anything about when they're being physicists. Okay, so the waking world is way more than the physical world. The waking world is the world as we experience it when we're awake. And the physical world is only a tiny part of the waking world. That makes sense to you? It's very important. Because the assumption that this is the physical world is wrong. This is the waking world. So it's a very important distinction to make. Now, the question is, how can we find the astral world, the vital world, right now? What would we have to do to get there? And the answer is couched in terms of this is a Sanskrit term, Pratyahara. And what Pratyahara means is the withdrawal of attention. So many forms of Eastern meditation consist in withdrawing attention from the senses. It's called Pratyahara, right? And so you sit down and you meditate and you basically train yourself to completely ignore all the information coming in on you from your senses. That's a kind of pratyahara. Now you can there's lots and lots of levels of pratyahara, but this is the simplest level of pratyahara, is you withdraw attention from the physical senses. Now doing this systematically and staying awake is very, very difficult. But we do something like this naturally, constantly. So let's say I was being less scintillating than I am, and you were getting bored. And so I'm droning on up here, and you would sort of begin to sort of move away. And you start thinking about the rest of your life, and pretty soon you'd be a million miles away having some fantasy, right? So you've withdrawn your attention from the physical senses, and you're now placing your attention in the world constellated by your transphysical senses, right? Only now you're doing both, right? Because you still hear me, but you're sort of in a daydream, and so if I drop my book or something, you'd wake up and notice that you're still here in the room because you're still plugged in, right? But you might also go further, and you might slip into a dream, right? So there you are, you've taken your attention away from the physical, but you're still halfway here. And then you completely drop your attention to the physical senses, and now you find yourself dreaming. You've just left your physical body and entered into the experience of your transphysical, vital, or astral body. Now, if you can do that lucidly, you're in business, right? If you can lucidly, you can now explore a whole new world. And there are lots and lots of books written about out-of-body travel, out-of-body experience, lucid dreaming. These are all variants on the theme. Right? So where's the transphysical world? It's right here. Right? We think we're in the waking world because we are hypnotized by the information we're getting through the physical senses, through the meat senses, through the body senses. That's what it means to be awake. It means to be hypnotized by the data coming in from the physical senses. But if we simply withdraw our attention from the physical senses, then we find ourselves in another world. It's as simple as that. Because we're already there. We already are in the vital astral world. We live there. Right? And then in the morning, the astral being enters its body suit. Right? The physical world is a kind of virtual reality for beings of the astral world. And the analogy is really precise, because when we're playing, like when we enter into Second Life or some computer game, right, we're acting through an avatar. Right? So there's some depiction of us in the game space. And the thing is, the actions of the avatar are completely controlled by the software. Now the software may give you certain choice points, like you can press your mouse button one way or the other. But the fact is, the possibilities of movement of your avatar are dictated by the game environment. You obviously have much less freedom in the virtual world than you do in the waking world, right? Because it's a simplified situation which we enter into for the sake of certain values that it highlights. Well, in the same way, the astral world is a world that's much less constrained than the physical world. The laws there are much less constrained. Space-time is much more flexible. Distance is defined in a completely different way. And so then what we do is these astral beings, and we have some memories of this from lucid dreams and great dreams and stuff, right? That being who lives in the dream world hypnotizes itself by focusing all its attention through the physical senses of the physical body, and then it's awake, right? Then we go to sleep, we simply withdraw our attention, and we're back in the astral world. Same thing happens at death, right? So survival, bodily death, from this point of view, becomes completely obvious because we're already not physical beings. We're already astral beings. It's a different way of looking at things, right? Now, another piece of evidence for this is that you've never seen the physical world because the physical world doesn't contain things like people and desks and plants. It contains atoms. But you're seeing things like people and desks and plants. How does that happen? Well, I would claim that your body is a mechanism, or a process, I don't use the word mechanism, is a living process which takes in the data of the physical world and presents it in values that we as astral beings can make sense of. So the body is sort of an interface between us and the physical world. This is a very different perspective than the one you're accustomed to. Now the question is, why isn't this obvious? Well, why is it such a weird idea? Well, part of it is because when we dream, or when we leave our physical body, we automatically regress to a fully mythical mode of understanding. Right? Now, in the waking world, in the mental mutation, we have learned to articulate objectivity. Now remember, in the mythic world, it's all a dream. And the idea of objectivity doesn't make any sense, because everything is just full of meaning and resonating with its meaning so fully that the idea of it having some particular location in the abstract scheme of time-space is kind of irrelevant. It's just not really worth paying attention to. There's a symbolic meaning that's important, right? And we don't, in the mythical mutation, we don't have a sense of time as linear, we don't have a sense of space as extended, and we don't have a sense of a set of laws that relates those things that are objective to each other. You understand what I'm getting at? Like, everything that's objective fits into the scheme of time and space. So they all can be related to each other by distance, right? But experiences all can't be fitted like that. But we take some of our experiences that we can fit into time and space, and we call them objective. Right? So we construct objectivity. And somehow this is an interpersonal cultural process of constructing objectivity. The objective world wasn't there before the mental mutation. Now we have created objectivity in the physical world. We have objectified the physical world for ourselves as an object of inspection. It requires a very intense focusing of attention to do that. On just the physical senses, on just measurements, on just experiments. That's what we have to do to define the physical world. We have to pull it out of experience by a huge effort. But now that everything else is left over, so now we can explain what happens in measurement. That's what science tells us. But what about love and life and hunger? I haven't got a clue, right? So then when we dream, or when we think mythically, we just give up on objectivity. It's all a dream. Right? Dream-like. What I'm suggesting, my radical suggestion, is that the way forward at this point in the human evolution involves bringing mental objectivity into transphysical worlds. In other words, when we dream right now, it's all about meaning and interplays of meaning. And that's true, right? But we could look at it in another way. We could wake up in our dream and say, okay, what are the physical laws here? Like in dreams, apparently, you can fly. Waking world, you can't fly. It's the way you can tell if you're dreaming or not, is by jumping. I tried this for weeks once. I figured if I jumped enough during the day to prove to myself I was awake, that I'd do it in my dream, and then I'd fly and then get lucid. It didn't work, but it's a good try. Anyway, so the point is that what I'm suggesting is that we can articulate a spatio-temporal and causal scheme of relationships that bind the transphysical worlds into an objective place. But the laws have got to be really different from the laws in the physical world, or the waking world. See, the waking world is dominated by the physical world in the sense that everything in the waking world, all the sensory experience, comes through the body, and the body is ultimately rooted in the physical world of inorganic occasions. And so there's a way in which the laws of the physical world dominate the waking space, the waking world. And so space looks geometrical to us. But actually, space, on the one hand, actually, as I said before, waking world is very dreamlike, and the dream world is very physical-like, because it consists of objects and people causally interacting in some kind of spatio-temporal framework. Follow me? Okay? And so this is my whole dream. Right? My whole dream is to bring mental objectivity into the transphysical worlds so we can wake up in these transphysical worlds and make them into an expanded theater for human activities. in a way which I think will allow us to replace mechanical technology.
Yeah. So you said that, I think if I understood, is like it takes almost being hypnotized to be in the physical world.
That's right.
So which is kind of the other way around when we think about it. But this hypnosis of our higher self allows us to be in this physical world. Now, I think when if you go online and play Second Life, and in the game you start talking about the mechanics of the game and how the program works, and this is actually not real, this is all a fantasy, and if you said that in the game, the other players will get pissed off at you because they're in Second Life to have this hypnotic experience.
That's exactly
really
right.
Believe that's real.
That's right.
And I often thought that maybe there was something less evolved about me that I kept wanting to talk about that, whereas common people just want to play the game that's here, and I keep saying, hey, you know this is just a game, don't you? And they're like, well, you shut up. Of course we know it's a game. Are you new? Is this your first time? I wanted to be a mailman, and that's why I'm here.
Right.
Be the mailman, and you keep talking about that other's world. And so that I'm conflicted between that and like the and waking up and having a better or a more evolved spiritual experience in the transphysical worlds due to this this objective lessons that we've gotten in the physical world. That's a whole new way of thinking that you're proposing. Of the involution into the physical world and evolving it back up.
Well, I don't want to use those words in this case, but yeah, I don't want to use involution and evolution here. It's too confusing, but I know what you mean, though. Yeah. Yeah.
How do you respond to the people that are really kind of mad at you for saying, hey, this is just a dream, we're all hypnotized?
With frustration, grief, impatience, and despair.
Well, I mean, that's how you deal with it personally, but what's your reason for wanting to wake them up?
Well, you know, I want to wake up. And that's really what I care about. I dedicated myself for decades to trying to figure out what the fuck is going on this planet. And I finally figured out an answer that I think might be right, and that is that we're going through a mutation of consciousness. And I'm trying to, not on my own, but working with the currents of thought in the 20th century, I'm trying to fabricate, to put together a symbolic form which will enable us to navigate this much larger universe that's opening up. So it's important to me, for my own internal reasons. And in a week like this, that's all I can tell you. Some other week, I might have a much better reason for that. But yeah.
I'm a little bit wary of the impulse. I get it, but at the same time, I also understand that mentality is really clever, and it can figure out ways to perpetuate itself. And like when you say bringing mental objectification into transphysical worlds, I think that can go two ways. It could bring us to this sort of reorientation or rediscovery of what it means to sense and to experience, but it could also encourage us to bring the same rigid senses or understanding of our physical senses into this world. And it could amount to us saying, I want to feel, I want to taste, I want to hear and see the transphysical world instead of actually wanting to experience it. Newer ways, or in...
I'm sorry, you seem to be following. I'm not exactly following. What are you hearing?
I can shorten the question. Are we saying that we want to experience the transphysical world in physical ways?
The physical world has certain properties to it that are really interesting. For example, the physical world always is a metrical geometry, right? And in the physical world, things are very conservative, and they stay the way you put them. So, for example, in the physical world, there are rulers and clocks because they hold their length and their oscillation. Nothing like that in the transphysical worlds at all. The rules there are completely different. And in fact, for example, I would claim that in the astral world, distance is a function of symbolic resonance. Right? So distance has nothing to do with measurement. It's something totally different. So it's not that we want to see the transphysical world as physical. It's rather that we want to articulate some understanding of space and time and causation that's flexible enough that it's adequate to what we do experience in the transphysical worlds. And also, in doing this, we'll also reveal the dreamlike properties of the physical world simultaneously. right? So it becomes more of an interfusion between the worlds, and that's the objective, right? The objective is to remember that our survival-oriented and our evolution-oriented actions are not limited to the gestures we make with our physical bodies, but that the gestures that we make with our astral body, dream gestures, are actual and causally effective, both in their own world and in the waking world. That's the point.
But what I'm seeing in the question is that, just to use an example, somebody who's coming to this notion for the first time might easily take what you said about, you know, mental and objective and stuff, and want to impose a deficient mental construction on a transphysical world.
Yeah, you can't.
And I think that's kind of what you're getting at.
That's right. And the answer is you can't do it.
Yeah, but you can try, and I think it's good that he's pointing out the danger. That's what I would say.
Yes. Okay, very good. I get it completely. What's interesting is you can't do it because there's no measurement there, and the whole deficient mental is based on measurement, and you can't do that in the transphysical world. This is right, and that's why, in order to make sense of the transphysical worlds, we have to completely change our understanding of the physical world, because right? it has to be different all the way up and all the way down.
How does that relate to dealing with our physical senses versus our transphysical senses? Saying
that we're seeing in the transphysical experience, you're relating that seeing back to that physical eye scene. And I think that's kind of... No, in the transphysical world, you don't see with physical eyes. You see with transphysical eyes. They're very different.
I guess maybe my question is, how are we going to distinct when we talk about something like that so that people understand that difference? Because we're using seeing the
can
same
you help
verb
me?
In the same
if you sense. See the difficulty, maybe you can help me think of a way to say it better. Yes? Not right now.
I think for us, experience is measurement. And
what?
It isn't, but that's the deficient mentality.
Yeah, that's right.
We measure, and only the things we measure are what we experience.
That's deficient mental. That's it. That's right.
And when you said the thing about the symbolic resonance, I know for myself, like, it's like, you know, I think you were talking, I don't remember exactly how you put it, but... I think you were talking about things being causally related to, or...
Yeah.
But anyway, again, instantly I want to put a deficient mental kind of construction on that.
Which says what?
Which says that, you know, the power of the symbolic resonance is a measure of maybe distance, right?
Yeah. And, well, you know, apparently not, you see. I mean, empirically speaking, it doesn't appear to be. There may be some elements of distance, but I can't see it obviously. I've been wondering about myself.
But what I'm saying, though, is that it's very difficult not to come into this with those kinds
yes,
of constructs.
That's right.
And so language is really critical here.
What we're going to be doing for the next several weeks now, starting after today, is developing a language in which we can have this discussion there. Right, so I've been trying to, up to this point, what I'm trying to do is make sure we have a background together, that we see where this issue stands, right? That we understand that the issue of the transphysical worlds is not just important for its own inherent interest, it's important because it seems that the evolution of consciousness and that the evolutionary predicament in which we find ourselves as a species requires us to open up the transphysical worlds as an evolutionary move forward. But we need a new language to do it. What I'm trying to do now is create the larger context so we can name the transphysical world, see how they were in prehistory, and get a sense of how they're relevant to everyday life. Now we're going to go into we're going to step back from the transphysical worlds into a reinterpretation of all of waking life to show how the transphysical worlds fit into it. So we'll be now reinterpreting both science and the transphysical worlds in terms of a new metaphysical position that I'll be articulating.
I thought that you said that evolution wasn't moving forward necessarily.
Evolution, by definition, moves forward, but locally, I mean, evolution is a description of a forward movement. But in the actual unfolding of evolution, there are cycles which go closer to each other. And so there are movements that depart from the privileged axis and movements that come back to the privileged axis. What I'm suggesting is that the movement that we've experienced from the archaic to the mental is a movement away from the privileged axis of evolution. and we're now hopefully going to come back to the privileged axis of evolution. And I'm hoping that these metaphysical ideas might make that transition easier.
Can I go back to the vital versus physical world?
Yes. Yes.
So you said that it's analogous to us in the physical world controlling the computer image,
yeah,
in a sense.
Yeah.
So does that mean that we, our astral body, because our physical body is still here when the computer body is there? So is the astral body also existing at the same time as our body, and our consciousness moves back and forth?
Yes.
Can it be in the same place at the same time?
Yes, because space is much more complex. You see, what I will be suggesting is that space is a much more complex structure than we realize it does. And that, therefore, in the new spatial structure I'll be outlining, it's perfectly possible for the transphysical body and the physical body to be at the same location.
I mean, the consciousness within them. Can you be in both at the same time? Can you be conscious of your physical body and your astral body at the same
yes.
time?
Yes, you've done it. You've never daydreamed. You've had that experience. So it's not that hard. Right. And ultimately, that's the objective. The objective would be that as we walk around in the physical world, we would be aware of the transphysical entities that are actually interacting with us. And I think that those transphysical entities are having enormous consequences on the surface of this planet. I mean, for example, I will claim that corporations are the bodies of these evil spirits that are that live on the astral world. They're the incarnations of asuras. And I can give the whole logic for that, but I think it's very plausible. Right? And the Vedic peoples would say that a lot of what's happening on our planet is the result of what they would call an asuric infestation, which means that these entities in the astral world who are trying to find God numerically instead of spiritually, in other words, they want to find God by maximizing power to the infinite or maximizing lust to the infinite, right? Instead of trying to transcend to find God. And so these beings, they incarnate in corporations, which are basically the expression of an asuric impulse to accumulate infinite amounts of money with no other purpose, right? It's a completely insane drive. It's an asuric drive. And I believe that the corporations are actually animated by the force of these transphysical beings. And if we don't start recognizing those beings and dealing with them in their own way, we're screwed, right? I mean, we have to start dealing with the reality of these transphysical beings if we're going to sort out what's going on in our daily lives. So that's my vision that I'm trying to present to you. Now,
I'm curious, when you say articulate your metaphysical position, in what sense are you using the word metaphysical?
I'm using metaphysical in the sense that a metaphysical body of ideas is a body of ideas that's, what does Whitehead say? He says they're logical, applicable, adequate, logical, and coherent. A system of ideas that is logical, coherent, applicable, and adequate. I'm going to leave that one off for now. You're right. But, so logical, meaning logical, in very straightforward sense of that term. Coherent, meaning that the body of ideas are all interdependent with each other. So the basic ideas of a metaphysical system should be such that what is unique about each one cannot be defined apart from reference to the others. Right? So your basic explanatory entities should all imply each other, because your metaphysical system is supposed to be reflecting the wholeness and coherence of the world, and if your ideas aren't coherent, they can't possibly reflect the coherence of reality. And then the ideas of metaphysics should be both applicable to various parts of reality, but also should be adequate to say something interesting about all of reality. And so if you have a body of ideas that pretends to be applicable all across all possible experience, and it's logical, that's a metaphysical body of ideas. Make sense?
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, it's also, as you, I'm sure you know, used in a more methodological or epistemological kind of sense. And
what does it mean?
The idea of metaphysics, for example, in the body of integral theory, refers to any claim that doesn't make explicit or make transparent in a reflexive manner the sort of methodological injunctions or the sort of epistemological structures or backdrops through which those knowledge claims are generated.
Now, so a metaphysical one is when that doesn't do that?
It doesn't.
When you're coming from a tradition that's very, very different from mine, you talk about Wilbur perhaps?
Wilbur and the
Well, I'm operating out of a very, very different tradition. and I have a completely different understanding of metaphysics. In fact, an opposite understanding. I would say it's only metaphysical if it is an explicit description of the background against which everything else has happened. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's not metaphysics in my definition of the term. So it's an opposite definition. Yeah. I appreciate you bringing that up. In other words, metaphysical ideas are the most general, basic ideas we can formulate about reality. That's how I use the term. Following way. Yeah. Okay. Thank you for bringing that clarification. Okay. What else did I want to say? You can ask questions while I look at this.
So, Eric.
Yeah.
The idea of the Asuric impulse. Corporations and things like that. So they're still trying to go to God.
Yeah, but backwards.
So that's why there's not, if one would say there's not really true evil, it's just a backward way of going to God.
You know, you could make that argument. I'm not totally comfortable with it, but it could be made. I don't really want to get into discussing evil because it's such a huge topic.
Yeah.
But I see where you're going with it. All right.
So, Eric, at what point are you going to sort of articulate, maybe you did this in the last class and I just missed it, but like your vision for how you're going to bring the mental into this kind of project to explore the transphysical?
Yes. So, what I'm going to do now, starting after this week, is I'm going to articulate a mental body of ideas, a metaphysical body of ideas, which is a description of the actual world and how we live in it. And I will show that if we look at reality this way, we can make complete sense of science and all its results and complete sense of the transphysical world altogether. So that's my move. My move is to say if we start out with science and try to get to the transphysical world, there's no way to get from one to the other. Because science is set up from its inception to exclude the presence of the transphysical factors. Right? So obviously you can't find using science because science excluded it from the get-go. Right?
How do you define science?
I'm talking about the hard sciences here.
The hard sciences.
I'm not talking about the hard sciences or the classificatory sciences, maybe you haven't thought about, but certainly the hard sciences.
But if you redefine science in a broader sense,
that's what I'm trying to do.
Qualitative and quantitative approaches and
that's what I'm trying to do.
Not limited to sensory data, or at least five sensory data.
That's right. Exactly. That's what I'm trying to do. But you know, some people want to say it's an expansion of science, and you can definitely do that, and it works. But it could also be seen as a destruction and recreation of science. I mean, you know.
And
I'm sympathetic to what you're saying.
The program to exclude the transphysical fails in quantum mechanics, right?
Well, they
all
do.
All kind of bizarre behavior shows up that's not going to fit the.
Well, in some way, the model of the physical world does break down at that point, and they have nothing to do with it. I mean, I do think that quantum theory is an inception of the integral mutation, as is relativity theory, as is Whitehead, as is Ormondo, as is Cassirer, all these inceptions of this new way of thinking. Quantum mechanics is one of them. And so quantum mechanics works embarrassingly well. And the question is, how do we make sense out of it? And I think that the metaphysical system I'm offering has resources for making sense out of quantum mechanics. That's my bid. Yeah?
I'm not sure if I exactly have a question, but I was struck earlier by what you were saying about the Inquisition and the witch trials, and the way that ideology, which is it's ironic because that was happening, you know, the church was really kind of behind that, and they were attacking Galileo and Bruno with one hand while they're, you know, attacking, and yet that just as Christianity and its view of, you know, there being sort of a coherent order to history and things like that is kind of what makes Western science possible as
that's
part of
right.
the background of that.
That's right.
This whole witch trial thing, which on some level I've mainly been, you know, always viewed from more of a feminist perspective, which is accurate as well.
Yes, absolutely.
But it's like, it's so earth-shattering to think about what is so deeply ruled out of order by our current scientific model. Yes. And yet it's, I don't know, I'm still kind of staggered by the realization that that's what made that, you know, the witch trials, the Inquisition. There's something about the way in which those were done.
Yep.
That makes homeopathy or, you know, whatever else, I mean, that's just close to home for me, just like, we're going to burn you with the fucking stake.
That's it.
And it's like, so I don't know if I have a question, but I mean, I'm really interested in that issue, and I think it's a really important one for those of us who are trying to actually make a change in how people
deal with this. It is an absolutely crucial issue. And you know, it's actually goes along with this freedom shock I was talking about earlier. We begin to realize that there's so many different ways we can interpret reality. And there's so much arbitrariness in it. And so, we're talking about the witch trials here. I've lost what I wanted to say about them. Give me a second here to decompose my mind. Yes, and so we have this freedom, and then the question is, why do we choose one idea over another? What makes us choose an idea? So, for example, in the readings you're going to do for this week in A.B. Burton, there's a quote from Bertrand Russell, which will hopefully knock your socks off. It's probably the most depressing thing you will ever read in your life. And basically, Russell is saying, you know, that the destiny of modern man is to finally face up to the ultimate meaninglessness of things and to soberly appreciate the fact that it's all going to die and nothing means anything. That's our heroic... right? And the question is, here's my question to you. Why would anybody believe that? Why would anybody choose to believe that there's no intrinsic connection between our experience and the rest of reality? Why would anyone choose to believe that the universe is set up merely to deceive us into thinking there's meaning when actually there isn't? Why would anybody choose to believe that the universe consists of a cruel joke? What kind of metaphysics is that? What kind of ontology is that? Right? It's the one we live with. Why?
Because it does give meaning in the midst of the chaotic environment. It's a way to say, all right, I'm done searching now. Evolution's over, I get it. I don't have to experience.
That's what I talked about at the beginning of the class, right? We get into that mood. And we get into a mood where we don't want to deal with ideas, and we just sort of want to be frozen in our heroic meaninglessness and just do everyday shit, right? Well, okay, but still, it's so incoherent. Any intellectual attention placed on these ideas of meaninglessness dissolves them instantly. And philosophers have known that from the beginning of the whole movement. Within 5 years of Newton, people were already showing how stupid he was. But we still love to believe it. I don't know why.
It works.
Well, it works in certain contexts, but why does it mean we have to believe it about all of reality? The fact that, that mechanics works in analyzing the movements of cannonballs doesn't mean we should assume that the entire universe consists of cannonballs. Right? Linda.
I don't know that much about Newton, but I don't think we should say he's stupid because, I mean, maybe he didn't mean it like that, but I believe there's a lot of evidence that Newton didn't even believe in the Newton worldview. He made those laws, he came to them, but he didn't believe that that was how the universe operated.
I apologize for my hyperbole.
I'm still trying to figure out how, if we can't bring measurement up from the physical worlds and the transphysical worlds, what is it are we bringing up? From the physical world. What is the science that isn't already in the transphysical world?
Well, remember that science, all the way from the Greeks until the Renaissance, did not concern measurement. It concerned classification. Mm-hmm. Right? So maybe we'll have to start with the classificatory science in the transphysical worlds and work from there.
It's process philosophy. That's not a measurement. It's functional science, right?
Yeah, functional science, but also the point is, it could just start, I mean, naively speaking, modern science started with classification and the logic of classification. That's where we started our scientific work. Maybe we'll have to do that in the transphysical world. Maybe we have to just start by categorizing the different entities there and start looking at those different entities and try to find relations between them. I mean, we got a whole new world to figure out how to think about. I don't know what's going to work.
Well, can we perhaps create spiritual functions that...
Yes,
like,
I think so.
Like in terms of Whitehead, we could create these functions.
That's what I'm trying to do.
If
exactly.
You reap what you sow, or you know, treat another as you would have them treat you.
Those are moral, but I think we could get a little more specific. Like, you know, if you project a certain mood in the transphysical worlds, it'll move you a certain distance to a certain place. Or if you think about somebody, you'll be next to them. Or, I don't know, there are rules like that, right? Mm-hmm. We have to figure out what those rules are. And then begin to understand our experiences and dreams as the exemplification of a set of rules that holds constant. Then we have an objective world. That's what it takes. It's not going to be a mathematical model, because you can't measure. But it's going to be a logical model of some sort that will let us navigate.
What about the aesthetic?
Aesthetics is going to be relevant everywhere also. But in this case, I'm particularly interested in the logical function. I mean, it's very hard to separate logic and aesthetics if you get deep enough, right? But I'm interested right now in the logic, because I'm interested in logic as a way of objectifying transphysical worlds so they become workable to us as part of our everyday lives.
It sounds like we're exploiting the next force.
Resource.
What?
Resourcing.
I know. I am aware that what I'm saying is dangerous. I'm aware that it goes against a lot of modern currents of thoughts. That in some ways it must seem to you atavistic or regressive. Or that I'm trying to take all the problems of the modern world and just import them into the dream life. I know that that's what you're thinking. But why? I'm doing this for a different reason. Because Gebser teaches that in order for us to move into the integral, as Denise was saying, we have to reappropriate the efficient part of the archaic, the magical, the mythical, and the mental. They're all valid. And we have to reappropriate their validity in an expanded understanding of the universe. Thomas Berry says something similar. He says we have to reappropriate the wisdom of the indigenous, the wisdom of the classical traditions, and so forth. It's a slightly different statement of the same idea. Now, I've said to you before that the historical analysis suggests that the transphysical worlds were intimate to human life all the way up until 400 years ago, where we made a mistake, had a collapse, or some necessary detour, whatever you want to call it, right? And we've lost. If we're going to move into the integral world, we have to be able to integrate all of our senses, including the transphysical senses, and we have to be able to make the mythical, the magical, and the mental all mutually transparent. In other words, we have to be able to think all of reality magically, all of reality mythically, all of reality mentally, and see how all of those descriptions describe the same reality. That's an integral understanding. Now, if we're going to bring mental, if it's going to be integral, it means we have to understand daily life as mythical and magical, but we also have to understand the transphysical worlds as mental. Right? And so that's what the transparency has to go both ways. Right? Now, there's a big difference between the deficient mental and the efficient mental. In the efficient mental, what's kept is a sense of the whole. So efficient mental philosophy is always an attempt to give a rational accounting of the wholeness and the coherency of all of experience. Right? We have to include our experience in dreaming life and in the transphysical worlds. So the point is that it's not just a question of re-enchanting waking life. It's also a question of mentalizing dream life. Because if they're going to be fully transparent, it has to go all these different ways. Right? And so I'm claiming that okay, I'll start with a difference between the efficient mental and... Oh, sorry, I got lost. The efficient and deficient. So in the efficient mental, there's a sense of the whole, of the wholeness. In the deficient mental, we throw out the wholeness. And so it's all about logical analysis, starting from premises and making measurements and mathematical deductions. And the overall context is lost completely. Right? So in the modern world, we have a whole anthropology based on sex, that's Freud's, and a whole anthropology based on money, that's Marx's, right? And all these other anthropologies based on physics and stuff, right? But we don't have any whole sense of what it means to be human. So we need a whole sense of what it means to be human, which means it has to include the magical and the mythical and the mental, all of which are causally relevant right now, and it has to include a mental penetration into domains that have hitherto been the province of the mythic and the mental. It has to go all complete transparency, right? That's why I'm advocating this. And I know it goes against superficial currents of thought, but I'm standing up for it because I think it's important. I'm hoping to persuade you. It's an interesting way to think about things.
I'm curious, like, also, you know, as you unpack kind of your vision around this, I'm also curious how you see this, you know, interfacing in the broader world, you know, how this, and particularly in light of these kinds of dynamics, these kind of Kuhnian paradigm dynamics, and the notion that it's not always the necessarily the most rational articulation that wins the day, unfortunately.
That's right.
And, you know, so I think that would be a really interesting backdrop for, I don't know to what extent you're planning on bringing that in, but for this discussion.
Say it again?
In addition to kind of getting into all this content and how would this project unfold, but also look at, like, who's going to buy this kind of vision?
Okay.
What's the pragmatic value?
Let me tell you. Where I put that, and I've written about this in various places, I'll just say it very simply now, is that if we look at the various mutations of consciousness up here, each mutation of consciousness is necessarily associated with what Marx called a mode of production. So, magic is hunting and gathering. You don't get a magical consciousness unless you're living naked in the woods. You're really right there. Right. So the magical mutation, hunting, gathering are go together. Mythic is all about village agriculture. Right? In other words, the whole understanding of life in terms of cycles is an agricultural understanding. When you're dealing with animal husbandry and plants, it's all about cycles. Mythic, right? When you do mental, it's always city states. Right? Because when you have a city state, what begins to become important is not so much the seasons, but what stays constant. Like you're competing with your neighbor who's also a shoemaker, right? And so the seasons don't matter. What matters is who's making more shoes and who's selling them at a higher price, right? So you get this idea that there are certain things that aren't responsive to seasons and just go on forever. These are the ideas, right, which are associated with city-states and the mental mutation. Now, when you get to the deficient mental, you get industrialism. Right? In other words, industrialism as a way of life is a function of the deficient mental mode of consciousness, which sees everything in terms of quantity and which sees measurable efficiency as the highest good. Right? So industrialism is the expression of a mutation of consciousness. Industrialism is also systematically and completely unsustainable. And it is ending in our lifetimes. I'm quite convinced. And so the question is, if we survive as a species, big question, will we survive as a species? If we survive as a species, and we're not going to be industrial, what's going to be our mode of production? How are we going to interact with the world around us to secure our needs? Right? And what I want to suggest to you is that the new mode of production is based on a transphysical technology. In other words, if, for example, we can learn to leave our bodies lucidly, the internet has become completely outdated because the bandwidth in the transphysical world is infinite, practically, compared to the physical world, right? We all know what a bummer the low bandwidth of electronic communications is. It's leaving us all miserably lonely most of the time. So we can get away with it, get rid of the internet, and just travel outside of our bodies. Think about that. Also, if we're able to move outside of our bodies and move into transphysical worlds, if there's going to be galactic federation, that's where it happens. Right? Because you can travel at the speed of thought in the astral world. You can be anywhere in the galaxy. You can actually have a galactic federation. You're not going to have a galactic federation in mobile tin cans that travel through empty space. Not practical. Not going to happen. Right? Also, health technology. Right? I mean, most of our health, as we know, is psychosomatic. Right? It has to do with the way our transphysical bodies interact with our physical bodies. Once we can function lucidly in the transphysical world, health will become completely transformed. We still may need surgery, if we can, maybe not, but everything else, right, we can do from the transphysical worlds. right? Agriculture. Think about the possibilities of agriculture if we can systematically cultivate our empathic and telepathic communication with the plants and the animals. I'm convinced that with the proper meditative techniques, we could teach plants how to mutate in ways that are beneficial to us. Right? These are transphysical technologies, right? Which will allow us to do everything that mechanical technology does without the ecological consequences. Now, are there horrible possibilities for that going wrong? I'm sure there are. But it's better than this, right? Yeah.
When you say the word technology, I get the sense that like we're going to need something to get to that point.
Yeah.
Instead of it's not just knowledge that we kind of...
I don't mean mechanical technology.
Yeah.
I'm talking about using our... No, the only machine we need is this. This, all the things that machines do, are our powers that we have projected into the machinery. Whatever machine does, we can do. We can fly. We can teleport, probably, right? I mean, you know, we can live without oxygen. We can do all kinds of things we can do. We can run for 40 miles an hour for 7 hours straight. There's a lot of things human beings can do. They're very well documented. Everything that machines do, we can do. Our job is to take the projections back from the machinery and to rediscover the potential of the human instrument, which is actually a divine instrumentation. Right? That's the objective here. That's how it fits into the current situation. That's why it's so important. Because as far as I can tell, it's the only way forward out of this industrial nightmare. Bill.
So how does spiritual development fit into this? Does an enlightened person... like Aurobindo obviously has access to many, many levels, even beyond talking about so far here, I think.
It's a very interesting.
Do they report? There's actually lots of mythology about flying bodhisattvas and
exactly
levitating and all
exactly
that kind of stuff.
So it seems pretty clear that the enlightenment experience. This is a very technical term. What I mean by the enlightenment experience is the experience of oneself as a pure, transcendent, timeless consciousness that's immune to circumstances. That's enlightenment. And everybody says that if you have the enlightenment experiences, accessing the transphysical world becomes really easy for some reason. It just seems to spontaneously happen once you get it. On the other hand, Sri Aurobindo says quite clearly and explicitly that if we can find a way to break through into lucid consciousness in the transphysical world, all the mystical experiences become very readily accessible because the vital body has much more access to those experiences than the physical body does. Right? So it's a complicated question.
Possible new practices.
What?
Possible new practices using something like that.
That's right. And so Sri Aurobindo's saying, at one point in Synthesis of Yogi, he says, look, you just got to, by hook or crook, you got to go to sleep without falling asleep. And then everything opens up from there. In other words, what he's saying is you've got to fall asleep without surrendering to mythic consciousness. Yeah.
When you spoke of the pygmies seeing through each other's eyes and having that, I just kept thinking, in that state, you can't really lie to someone.
That's right.
You can't hide yourself.
That's correct.
So for the integral to happen, there has to be redemption, I believe, of the soul. And that's a big spiritual problem. That I think is going to be a barrier.
You're absolutely right. And you know, part of it is that as we start to recognize the trans... See, because something else I was going to talk about was the trans-physical dimension of the waking world. So what I want to say is that the trans-physical worlds totally permeate the waking world. And one way to see this is do a little thought experiment. And some of you may have done it before, but we'll start by just picking up any inorganic object, anything, and holding it in your hand. And feel the thingness of the thing in your hand. It doesn't do much. Right? It's kind of passive. It's kind of definite. It just sort of is what it is. It doesn't really reach out to you. It's just there, right? Now, imagine holding a puppy. Can you see how different that feels? Right? It's like a totally different experience. Because now holding the puppy, there's this kind of mutual transparency. It's like the puppy has an inner life and the inner life of the puppy and my inner life are resonating, and I feel its psychic presence. I actually feel it, right? I don't deduce it from the sensations. I actually feel it. And that's a transphysical causal interaction. That's a causal interaction between my vital body and the vital body of the puppy. Right? So that's sort of the transphysical dimension of the waking world. We're both, even though the puppy and I are both incarnated in physical bodies, we're also both existing on the astral world, and we're having causal interactions directly on the astral world that are not mediated through the physical. It's the transphysical dimension of the physical world. And that's something to do with your question. Who just asked the question? Was you? Who just asked the last question?
I was just talking about the transparency.
Yeah.
In that it's a magical mutation of the pygmies.
Right.
That there's a transparency that...
That's right. So part of this is that as we move into a deeper awareness of this, we begin to realize that privacy is an illusion. Period. Right? Privacy is an illusion based on inattention, basically. But you know, as the psychics among us will tell you, there's nothing about your inner life that isn't available to direct inspection right now. There is no privacy. Right? Anybody who's good enough at it can sit down here and just tell you all your secrets. Just like that. Right? And so as we all move into the integral consciousness, and as these various mutations become more transparent to each other, we're going to lose privacy. It's going to become a thing of the past. You think it's bad on the internet. It's a lot worse than the transphysical world. It's so intense in the physical world that we're going to have to redefine what it is to be an ego completely. You can't have isolated egos in the same way in the transphysical worlds, because the isolation that supports egohood and waking life has to do with the physical separation of the body from other bodies. But you don't get that level of separation in the transphysical worlds, where bodies sort of run into each other and melt into each other. You don't get that kind of separation. It's a very different world.
I thought that was one of the advantages of the physical world, was that we can choose who we share ourselves with and to what extent. And in the transphysical worlds, that's just not an option.
Well, you can see that as an advantage or as a disadvantage, depending on your mood. Depends on how lonely you are, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
You mentioned in the transphysical worlds that we can travel at the speed of thought.
Yeah.
What is the speed of thought? And like, how does it compare to
what I meant was that in the transphysical world, in the astral world, for example, we appear to be in a place that corresponds to how we're feeling. So in the astral world, if your mood changes, so would your physical location, your perceived location. And so it happens just like that. Right? Where you are in the astral world depends on how you feel. So from going from one place to another, you don't get there by moving your legs, you get there by shifting your mood. So it's a very different understanding of space and time.
So is that the kind of thing that we should try to experience in our dreams? Like, okay, I'm standing here in front of a room, but all of a sudden I'm in a different room. How did I get there?
That's it.
Because are we going to be talking more about like what we can actually do?
I hope so, but you guys have to bring it up. I mean, I'm presenting a theory. My objective is to provide a language in which we can have these amazing discussions about what's happening in the transphysical worlds. Like I said, I've reached a point in my work where I can't go much further without collaboration. I need other people to talk to, other people to provide data, other people to help me apply these ideas to experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really the key, too, because I think any valid theory has to be socially validated.
That's right.
And my understanding is that one of the reasons why the whole introspectionist project in psychology kind of...
The what project?
The early introspectionist, yes. Wundt and so yes. forth, kind of petered out is because of the problem of inter-individual variability, that two people do the same practice and have radically different experiences, and there's no way, at that time, they found no really convincing way to, how do we explain that variability?
Yeah, and that's a huge problem in the transphysical world. Because even in the physical world, we all see things differently. We all know that, for example, it's quite plausible that what I call blue is different from what you call blue. I don't really know, right? And we all have individual ways of interpreting, and we all know that every moment of experience is an artistic composition, and each one of us composes it differently. And yet, we're able, somehow or other, to muddle through to find a common objective world. how we do that is a really, really interesting question. But I can tell you this, in the astral world, it's a lot harder to do because the variability among perceptions is much greater, right? And because in the physical world, for example, I'm going to say the words I'm saying, and I'm pretty much counting on the air to pass them through unchanged. But in the astral world, that probably wouldn't happen. Because the air itself would be so alive, it might reinterpret the words as they get propagated. So how to work in the vital world, in the astral level, is quite complex. I don't know the answers.
But you couldn't lie, and I don't think you could miscommunicate.
Actually, I don't think that's true, because we could be mental beings incarnate in the vital world, and although we couldn't hide our emotions, I could probably hide our thoughts. So ultimately, there's no privacy, but it gets stripped away by degrees as we go through the various transphysical worlds.
Did you have conflated logic or bad logic in the? I guess if there's beings trying to obtain God state by through a circ methods, then there's got to be something like illogical about that. Or
something what? I hear.
I was thinking, can you have bad logic in the?
There's nothing but bad logic everywhere, and you can have it anywhere, right? So Sri Aurobindo talks about these beings in the mental plane. He says they create matter by hidden stress of mind. Think
so
about
that. Dissonance. They create a dissonance.
Not exactly what it means, right? But he's saying that basically matter comes into being by a certain operation on the mental plane that limits things somehow. I don't want to go into the details. The point I'm getting at.
Well, Whitehead's increased complexity and harmony.
What?
Whitehead talks about increased complexity and harmony.
Yeah.
As the desire of God.
Right.
And maybe these asuric beings create dissonance and
they do.
Simplicity.
That's correct. They're sort of anti-evolutionary. I mean, Aurobindo would probably say, I know Alice Bailey would say this, that the evil forces are the loyal opposition. That evolution would be boring if it weren't for the opposition. Because if there weren't evil forces, we would just automatically evolve right back to God, just like that, nothing getting in the way. And so the evolution has to be made difficult and interesting by God also manifesting the opposing forces that create chaos and disharmony to make the evolution more fun. So it's the loyal opposition. I see the evil forces of the loyal opposition in some way, also divine, part of the evolutionary scheme. Yeah.
Are you using vital body and astral
yes,
body?
Yes, that's synonymous.
As synonyms? Okay.
I am.
Yeah.
Not everybody does that. There's lots of different words. I'm in general going to use. Sometimes the vital body is reserved for what's called the etheric body. And I'm not even sure exactly what that is, the most confusing of all the bodies. So I'm just going to say the vital body for now. Those details aren't important for the level we're discussing at this class. We have to get much more advanced to make those details important. Yeah,
let's go. I don't know if I should bring this up, which is why I'm bringing it up. It's more of a personal account. Like, I've always felt like I've sort of been in tune with sort of the astral world, and I've had trouble dealing with the physical world because of it.
Yeah.
And so I'm still confused about my relationship with this material because I don't know how to describe some of these things, and I don't really know what level of those things I'm actually experiencing, because I've always been in this conflict.
Yeah.
So, resolving that for me.
That's right. I'm hoping that I'll provide some ideas that will let you make some discriminations that'll be useful. So, we'll see. Right? That's my sister's like you. My sister's a psychic, and she doesn't quite live in the physical world. So, for example, she can't read maps. She was practically shut in at home until she got her navigator, right? Because she really just can't keep track of spatial relations.
I'm the same way.
Right? So she's living much more in a mythic world, much more in a transphysical world, and not really tuned in to the logical relations that make us able to perceive the physical world. So we have to do both to function.
I felt dysfunctional.
Yeah, so I'm hoping that some of these ideas will help you sort that out. Maybe we'll see. But, you know, I hope you'll keep that question alive and see whether what I'm saying helps you to sort it out, because that's what I'm trying to do.
I think it's similar to navigating the ocean. it's a different type of way to navigate versus land.
Yeah.
The maps are different. Like there's.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the maps are going to look like, but we need them. I have some ideas, which we'll get into. Right?
As you, you know, articulate kind of your vision, I'd be really curious, if, you know, to hear, you know, the kind of methods that you used to come at, to arrive at these kind of claims, and so if it's like, you know, some of the things you're saying, this is a rule that I'm speaking about as a sort of third person rule that's functional in the transphysical. Did you arrive at that through your own kind of introspective methods, or is that, did you hear that through Aurobindo or Bailey or et cetera? So that, to me, knowing that allows me to interpret what you're saying at a whole nother level.
Yeah, you may have to keep asking me, but let me tell you in general that, I'll tell you a story. In 1996, I went into retreat for several months because I wanted to see if I could create systematic access to the transphysical world. And I had this idea that I would do it through the cultivation of one-pointed concentration so I could do pratyahara. And I spent 2 months in solitude doing that and discovered I couldn't do it because it turns out that the texts are all true and you can't do that without being a complete renunciate. And I'm not a complete renunciate, and so I just couldn't mobilize the concentration because I couldn't calm my system down enough. And so I realized I wasn't going to be yogi this life. And so I decided that what I was going to try to do was to create a map of the transphysical worlds, a little more like, what's the guy? Vico, who's the guy who did the mapping in the Renaissance?
Yeah, I can't tell
us who it was. I forget his name. Anyway, some guy did the map. So I'm the mapper. I decided to do the map. I decided that I was going to stay in waking world and create a map of the transphysical worlds because I figured people like me are going to need the map to get there. And so I studied Sri Aurobindo a lot. And I found his expression of the cosmology satisfying. However, Sri Aurobindo did not have the conceptual resources to let me bring this cosmology all the way down to the level of everyday life and science. In particular, I spent months trying to figure out what would Sri Aurobindo say about the collapse of the wave function? Now, what would he say about relativity theory or quantum theory? And the answer was nothing. He just didn't have the conceptual resources. He had room in his system for those things, but he didn't do any of the work. Right? And so then I found Alfred North Whitehead, and his analysis of waking life turned out to have all the equipment I needed to also analyze the transphysical worlds. And so all that's theoretical. It's supplemented, however, constantly by my own ongoing experiences, which are not especially remarkable. You know, I mean, I've had various lucid dreams, I've had a, you know, come out of body experience, you know, like, I mean, I haven't. I've had lucid dreams and mystical experiences And I have, for some reason that I cannot account for, a complete conviction in the objective existence of the transphysical worlds, which I had from the moment I first read about them, and can offer you no justification for that. Mm-hmm. Right? So it feels to me like I'm operating out of an experience base that's larger than I have conscious access to. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty convinced that a lot of interesting things are happening at night when I'm sleeping that I can't quite bring back in my waking life. Mm-hmm. I feel that, and I have my own experiences, and I have theory. And that's what I'm working for.
Great, thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, one last question, anybody? Yes?
Well, I think you brought up a really interesting point that what you're saying, I see it, I don't see it, I know it as a truth. So I don't need you to justify it to me. And so I feel like that's why this class is so interesting, is that you're saying things, and there are those moments where we're going to need justification, and then knowing when we wind the justification is when we're actually not where maybe you want us to be.
I'm sorry, I lost. I'm very interested. Say it again.
So when we're asking for justification of what you're saying, I feel like that's actually bringing us back into the mental.
Yep.
And we're getting lost in getting stuck again in that mental part, instead of just like allowing what you're saying to be known.
Yep.
And sitting with that knowing.
That's right. And you know, it's just different activities.
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be really fun to do what you're talking about also. I mean, really, I'm interested. Like, what if we just sat together and just, I would like to just get together. It's okay. How are we experiencing the transphysical worlds right now? And just talk about it.
Can we do that?
What? We could do that maybe later, right? But there's something else I want to do. And this is a graduate class. Right? And so, yeah, we know this. Some way in which we know this, right? But all of the ideas we receive from our culture make it problematical and suspicious and confuse us because we can't actually say what we're experiencing without contradicting deeply held popular beliefs. Right? And I see us needing a cultural shift as well as an individual shift. And so what I'm trying to do is to articulate a body of ideas which does full justice to science while allowing us to speak about the transphysical world. This is for a cultural reason, right? For your own personal practice, this course may be marginally useful. I mean, I think when we may discover ways of designing spiritual and occult practices out of this way of thinking. I haven't quite gotten to that yet. You might help me with that. But mainly, this is a cultural work that we're doing in this class. Is we're saying, how can we take this thing that we know to be true and answer the critics that haunt our waking life? Right? And how can we actually move the whole scientific enterprise, right, in some way that makes it open to these vastly expanded human possibilities that can get us out of our current evolutionary cul-de-sac? So it's not just for us.
Right, so it's a separate practice, I guess, what you're kind of saying, is that this is a space where we do need to be kind of in the mental to know the critics and know what we're coming against, and then also have a space.
That's right. Also, I don't know about you, but me, I grew up a scientist, right? I mean, when I was a little kid, all I wanted to do was be a scientist. I wanted to wear a white lab coat, you know, and shit, right? And so, because that was the glamorous idea of the knowledge priest that I had as a kid, right? And so when I have to say things that scientists laugh at, it's painful. Right? I mean, I do it all the time, and it's always painful. Right? And so for me, just having to prove to myself that I knew what I was talking about took 30 years. I want to make it easier for you. Right? Okay. Good class.
Just a note, I sent out an email about the study group. Anybody who didn't get it, I don't have your email. If you'd like to give me your email.
I heard great things about the study group this morning, by the way.
So, yeah. And maybe I have it as well by now.
Okay, read the bird. We'll see you next week.
Does anyone here play WoW? I'd like to talk to you. Play WoW.
Does anybody have the number of...